author of The Gunnery Diaries, Allison Flowers, from the podcast Chewing, Louisa Chu and Monica Eng, and comedian Chris Gethard. Now here's your host, a man who is also working without a budget, Justin Kaufman.
I wish there was that much argument and political rhetoric around my choices. I think I should get a bag of chips. Don't get a bag of chips. You're ruining the state. Or something like that, okay? I need to get one of those fancy budget programs for your computer. You know, the ones that just tell you how much you could spend, how much you can't. Because right now, I'm actually on a roll. I'm not spending a ton of money. What I get nailed on is like the city sticker or the license plate sticker.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I've learned over the time of doing the show to be very frugal when it comes to Michigan Avenue. Potbelly's on Michigan Avenue, always a little bit more than everywhere else. You know, like I'd always pop out around 6 o'clock and I'm like, I'll just get some fast food. Fast food down here, $12. It's always around $12. So I start bringing stuff from home. But I feel like I'm always. I mean, it's not my choices that are getting me for when I go over budget. It's always all the little things that I have to do. $100 here, $100 there that is taken out. You know, for a gym membership or for renewing your license plate sticker, which I did today.
Congrats!
It took me an hour and 40 minutes.
That's all.
To get from the turn lane on Elston, a block on Webster. The emissions testing is a block off of Elston. So from the turn lane on Elston and Webster to one block on Webster to the actual facility took me an hour and 40 minutes.
What?
Imagine that. And anyone who was a part of it or anyone who drove by, they know I'm not exaggerating. We talked about this last night. So anyone who's listening right now is like, what? The emissions testing is all kind of screwed up. And I sat through yesterday. I thought I could beat the system. I thought I could beat the system. So when I saw a huge line at Webster and Elston, I'm like, oh, it must be because everybody in the city is so lazy. Now I'll one up them. I'll fly out to Addison.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I'll get over to Lombard Street, 425 Lombard Street.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? On the process, I'll have something to talk about tonight. I'll check out Addison. I'll check out the Lombard. I'll check out what was the other town there? Elmhurst.
Sure, they're lovely.
You know, and get a chance. There's a safari, like a safari land or something, like some sort of play kids thing that's in one of the strip malls right there on 64.
Really? Sounds nice.
Yeah, right. See, I'm research.
Yeah,
I'll write it off. So I got out there, and there was a 5 mile line to get the emissions tested. You could read about it all over the place. It's the screw up of the year.
I don't understand. How could they fit that many car? How many, like in Elston and Webster there? Like
it's the most creative thing you've ever seen in your life. It goes through essentially three lanes of traffic in one lane. And everyone is just inching. Just think about rush hour when you're, on a tight, like on Belmont, when everyone's just trying to get through a Belmont and Broadway,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's just like, oh, I'm going to sneak. This is my chance. I'm going to sneak right here when there's a Cubs game. That's what it's like. And there's still cars parked, you know, so you only have like one car length, essentially, width to get down Webster. But everyone just, I've never seen so many cars come together in almost like a ballet of cars. And then the one person who's like, you know what would make this better if I honked? You know what? Something must be up because it's a green light again. Meep, 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 meep. Like doing it over and over and over. Like they're honking on me. Oh, my God. I'm sorry. You know what? I was having this conversation. I'm sorry. I got to go. This is wide open. It's wide open.
I hate car honkers.
I know. They're the worst. Tonight, huge show tonight. This is an amazing show. I'm going to go to the lineup real quick because we want to get going here. Mike Fouché is going to be here after the news, talk about the budget fallout, how it affects Chicago and Chicago schools. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Allison Flowers is going to be here, an investigative journalist in town. She wrote the book Exonery Diaries, which is getting a lot of buzz. It's just put out this week. It showcases it and really focuses on four stories of exonerees and what happened to them, how they got out of jail, but then also how they've been living their lives since. Antoine Day is one of the featured or profiled exonerees, and he's going to join us tonight to tell his story. Can't wait to talk with him at the big table coming up at 8 o'clock. Also, New York comedian Chris Gethard's coming to town for the AV Club Festival, which is down at Thalia Hall this week, pretty much Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Big festival. Chris Gethard is a tremendous performer. You can hear him. I mean, he's in the Chris Gethard Show, which is on Fusion, but he also is on Broad Cities in the new Mike Birbiglia movie. We'll talk with Chris coming up later in the show. Louisa Chu, Monica Ang will be here chewing the podcast. We'll talk about McDonald's big move. Are they coming to the West Loop? Very interesting. Cranes broke that. We'll talk about also Navy Pier. It was kind of promo today about the about what we think of the new Navy Pier. And then also about third-party delivery services. You're seeing more and more of these services popping up, almost like Uber for delivery, for food deliveries. There's some chefs that are actually pushing back, saying that it's not good, that they're scamming the system and they're taking advantage of their food. And we'll talk with Louisa and Monica about that coming up a little bit later. Also, it's picnic tonight. This is where we're giving a legitimate, authentic nickname to every one of the 2016 Chicago Cubs. Tonight, 10 o'clock, 312-981-7200 for a free pizza. Nickname for Ben Zobrist. Oh, we've been waiting on Ben Zobrist. A lot more to come tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. 815 says, so any environmental benefit of proving your car had low emissions was just wiped out by all the time you spent idling in line. It's sort of the text of the night, right? Ugh. All right, let's get the show on the road. It's time for the carryout. This, of course, is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The spring session is over and state lawmakers were unable to pass a budget. Although some lawmakers expressed optimism that the stalemate was breaking. Both the House Republicans and the Senate Democrats stepped out of line at the end of the session. But let's really call it out here. This, all of this, it's all about politics. Duh. But if the Dems pass a budget that's unbalanced and suggests a tax increase, they're going to lose in November. If the Republicans don't fulfill the Rauner promise of reforms and also have to pass a tax increase, they will lose in November. Both sides are guilty. Both sides don't want to compromise. They just want to win in November. But the problem with that is that there is a November every year. And that's all our leaders in both chambers and the governor's mansion care about. Don't be fooled by misdirection and campaign-like tours today. This is all about laying blame for a win in November. So for as much as Governor Rauner talks about reform in Springfield, I think he's figured it out, or maybe he already knew, that this is all about votes. And if you think that's not true, take a look where he's at today, campaigning. All right, let me step down for a second off my little soapbox. Here we go. Let's move on. Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson said that all officers are now trained in using tasers. Don't tase me, bro! That's a good thing until everybody hates tasers, and then we'll train them in using billy clubs. And then everybody will hate that, and then we'll train them in finger wagging. One wag? Hey, we're concerned. Two wags? Hey, don't do that again. Three wags? You're going to jail. See how many wags I wagged? It turns out May was the deadliest May since 1995. 1995, hey, that's the year MJ came back and lost to the Magic. That's a summer with a heat wave. Mayor Daley took over the schools. So I can understand the violence. This year? Come on, it's ridiculous. I'm glad we didn't get the Olympics. Our violence epidemic, it's worse than Zika. Tough couple days for Chicago area traffic due to a snafu in the Secretary of State's office. Drivers have been lined up for miles to get last-minute emission tests before they can renew their license plates. It seems to be caused by the budget stalemate as the office stopped sending out notices because, you know, stamps. I was a part of this mess this morning, and I've never waited in such a long line in the past 35 years of Chicago driving. I'll tell you, I'm not voting for another term for Jesse White. Who's with me? Everybody! And you know what? I'm going to even take it further. I'll try not to turn my back on the tumblers this summer. I'll try.
I said good day, tumblers. Good day. Tom Ricketts made his case at city council today for an open-air plaza outside Wrigley that would stay open till the wee hours, serving alcohol to fans. The alderman was for it. Now he opposes it. I'm sure it has to do with politics, because the idea of limiting alcohol sales outside Wrigley seems completely ridiculous. Have you seen Clark Street lately? I mean, they're putting bars inside bars. Archaeologists found 2,000-year-old writings in London. So what does it say? It's hard to make out, but I think it's here. There once was a man from Nantucket? In weather, so rainy, but now it's hot. So there you go. In sports, the White Sox won a series. Extra, extra, the White Sox won a series. The Sox won in 13 innings today to take 2 of 3 from the New York Mets. Hey, hey, hey. Reliever Matt Albers hit a big double in the game. I think his first ever, and he closed the game out. Nice work. This is the first series win for the White Sox in almost a month. Now they get a breather. Yeah, they go to Detroit for the weekend. Come on, when do we get the Twins again? We just one more series with the Twins? Or 2 or 3? The Cubs didn't get the record for 24 straight wins while Jake Arrieta was on the mound, which is so typical Cub. So cursed. God. The Cubs look to bounce back from the loss tonight against the Dodgers at Wrigley. Nationally televised game, too. Former Cub Marlon Byrd was busted for performance-enhancing drugs today. Second offense. Now with the Indians, he will be suspended for the full year. That's what he gets for playing for the Indians. Not a great start for the Chicago Sky. They stumbled out of the gate with a record of 2-4. They're playing tonight against the Washington Mystics. Hey, if I were in charge of the WNBA team in D.C., I would sell Mystics pizzas. What do you think of that? Or Mystics nachos or Mystics pizza. No, push the pizza, push the pizza. It makes sense. Trust me, kids. And finally tonight, the new AP-style guidebook is out and says that the L in Chicago is spelled with the letter L, not L. Next, they're going to tell me that Da Bears is The Bears and that Troop is Throop and that Antony is Anthony. Not buying it, Associated Press. Go back to Princeton or wherever you came from. That's the carryout for June 1st, 2016. Hey, we opened our ice cream window on the side tonight. We don't have ice cream, but who doesn't like a little window? And it's called the L.
More to come tonight. Mike Fouché is going to be with me after 7:30 to talk about the budget implications or lack thereof. Also, Allison Flowers and Antoine Day will be here to talk about Exoneree Diaries, new book out by Allison. That's coming up. You're on 720 WGN. It's a download. Stay with us. Okay, the Cubs are already underway on ESPN. Strikeout for Ben Zobrist, but that's not going to matter because tonight we're playing Picnic. It's Ben Zobrist, Rob Martire. Are you excited about that?
Oh, the big Z.
It's already done.
Done.
You did it.
Done. I just throw it down like that. Mic drop. I'm done. I don't have to worry about it the rest of the night. The big Z.
Sometimes you take a little bit more time. You go into the depth. Sometimes it's gut.
When it's a guy like Zobrist, though, and it's that visceral, you just you go with it.
Z. What was Carlos Zambrano's nickname? Did he have a nickname? Suspended?
Headcase.
Headcase.
Silly man.
Well, that's coming up at 10 o'clock. We will do Ben Zobrist. I expect more out of you, Rob. I expect a full research.
I'll dig a little deeper.
I'll dig a little deeper.
But
that was pretty good.
That was the inside me.
That's right. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. It is Wednesday, so it's time for AlderTrack, Mike Fouché. AlderTrack, of course, the subscription news site that covers all things Chicago and Illinois politics. Good to see you, Mike. How are you?
Great to be here. And was that New Edition?
It was. Cool It Now.
I think that's my theme now.
Thank
you, Pete.
It's definitely a good song to talk about the heating up of the rhetoric.
Yeah, man.
Cool the rhetoric. Right. That's what Pete was going
Take
for.
Take a chill.
So let's talk about this. So we know up to last night, we were talking to lawmakers on the program last night, up to the last minute where they weren't able to get the budget done. You know, Governor Rauner has talked about this being a failure, an embarrassment.
At 5 o'clock, he had a press conference. yesterday before all the final votes, and he had already declared the Democrats a failure. And it wasn't just your average everyday press conference. He had made sure that everyone got the satellite coordinates, and he did it at 5 o'clock so that it would be sure to be on all the local news across the state where he could say the Democrats are a failure before the votes were even taken.
It's hard for me to fathom, and you know, I kind of talked about it in the carryout, but it's hard for me to fathom that the budget and not passing the budget is a strategic political move for both parties. Explain.
Well, I mean, you know, really what this all comes down to, Mark Brown had a terrific column in the Sun-Times this morning, which is what this all comes down to is that Bruce Rauner wants to pass the turnaround agenda. And we've talked about what the turnaround right. agenda is. And they are items that don't have to do with the budget, but unless Democrats are willing to pass components of his turnaround agenda, he is not going to approve a budget. The other part, there's two other parts too, though, which is that Illinois needs a tax increase, and the Democrats don't want to wear that jacket, put it in Chicago parlance. Mm-hmm. And the other is that Chicago public schools need a lot of money. Now, Republicans have been calling it a bailout. Fine, if that's the word you want to use, but they need more money or else schools are going to have to close in Chicago.
And that obviously has been what we've been talking about for the last couple months now, just about the troubles.
I mean, it's been a year. Nine months. Yeah. I mean, we've been talking about this.
And it seemed that the Senate Democrats wanted to push that through last night, an education bill that would fund schools in the state of Illinois, including Chicago,
yep.
Give more money to. Right. The big arguments right. that have been happening over the last right. 2 months that are fruitless right. at this point. But talk about why that didn't come out and what are the political implications around schools.
The first thing that happened is that the House, led by Speaker Madigan and the Democrats, passed a budget a few days ago, I think Thursday, that gave $400 million extra to the Chicago Public Schools, but it also required essentially a tax hike of 5.5%, an income tax hike on average in Illinois of 5.5% to raise another $7 billion in order to pay for all the appropriations that they did. But they didn't put in the tax hike. They just mm-hmm. did the spending.
Right. That's why Republicans seized on that, saying it was unbalanced and,
right.
and it was
right.
Irresponsible. Right. And how can
and
they
that,
do this?
That's the failure part that Rauner was talking about.
Right.
And so then the Senate, led by the Democrats, and they have a supermajority, so they can do anything they want, they rebelled against that. And they felt like, you know, we're sick and tired of Madigan jamming stuff down our throat. We don't think it's actually enough money for Chicago public
wow.
schools.
Okay.
And they voted against it. And they also said, look, we don't like the idea that we're going to be voting for something that doesn't have the money to pay for it. So they voted against it, and they killed it in the Senate. The Democrats killed a Democrat House bill. And so then the next thing that they did is that they created what's called a clean education bill. And Rauner has been asking for a clean education bill, so there's nothing attached to it. And they created a clean education bill that has even more education spending for Chicago. And that went to the House, and that failed because the House Democrats didn't vote for it. So Democrats are fighting Democrats in the two different
now,
houses.
Now, that's I have some thoughts on that. Because
I'm sure you do.
Well, I find it interesting because I do feel that Speaker of the House, Mike Madigan, Speaker Madigan is a very shrewd and strategic politician.
Right.
It doesn't feel as if the bill that they put together, the appropriations bill that was unbalanced, quote
right.
unquote.
Right.
That they ever thought that was going anywhere. All that really was a press release, essentially, to say this is what we think the state needs. And Bruce Rauner right away said he was going to veto it, so they
right.
knew it was dead on arrival.
Right.
But it showed this right. is what we think. I mean, it became right. like this is what
well,
our points are. So
yeah.
it almost on point, like the say the House Democrats rebelled in any form, it's such it feels
Senate
to me
Democrats,
like a very
yeah.
or Senate Democrat. It's just very hollow. Like it,
well,
you knew it wasn't
going to
go anywhere.
I think the point is that Madigan wanted it to go through the Senate and pass the Senate. And so then Rauner would be stuck
He'd
with this
thing. He'd be the
veto
thing.
Guy. He'd yeah. be the veto guy, and he would have to veto it. And he would be – and so then Democrats could spend the summer and the fall saying, Rauner is against education. No. You know, he hates you. So – and so now where we're at is that schools are threatened with closing or not opening because schools across the state need money in
right.
order to open in the fall, not just Chicago. And not only K through 12, but also some of the smaller universities. So NIU, Western Illinois, you know, some of those places that really rely on the state cash in order to keep going.
Now, but do you think that I mean, that'll play out, that's a chip, and it does seem to me that the Democrats kind of want to hold that up, because don't you feel that once you get to August and September, if schools aren't going to open on time, that's the governor's problem?
Yeah, man, right? I mean, if everybody's a pawn, who cares? I mean, that's essentially where we're at, is that, you know, we're nobody's, you know, people who rely on state funding for anything, you know, whether it's social services, you know, suicide prevention hotlines, domestic abuse prevention or assistance, you know, homeless programs. There's a long list
all
of
sorts,
things.
Yeah.
You know, people who are disabled that need in-home nursing care. There's tens, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, and they're going to suffer. And schools are in danger, too. Now, there's a whole other extra level here, which is that even though we've been talking about assigning money to CPS from the State House, you know, $400,000, $500,000, that doesn't even come close to cracking the $1.1 billion that CPS extra needs for next year.
Because the pension payment is going to balloon and spike.
It's because they are so far deep in all of their costs, and they don't have enough revenue, and they are not allowed to raise property taxes. CPS is not allowed by state law to raise their property taxes. They have a cap.
So what are some of the plans that are on the table to deal with a $1.1 billion deficit?
Well,
I mean, are lawmakers asking?
Yeah, I asked the mayor about this yesterday, and you know, he kind of danced around it. He didn't really answer it. And then Mike Flannery came in with the 1-2 punch behind me and asked the same question again. And the mayor then basically said, well, we've always expected that there would be a three-way handshake between the state, unions, and Chicago taxpayers. Hmm. So what he's saying is that there would have to be a CPS tax increase.
But, and there would have to be concessions from the teachers union. And
right.
There would have to be more funding
than
is being
state.
Talked about from the state.
But in order for CPS to raise property taxes, the state legislature needs to give the okay for it to happen. Now, there's this whole other horrible possibility, which is that the state legislature doesn't do anything. And so we get to late July, and the city of Chicago has to do something. And so what they end up doing is raising city property taxes, which effectively for the taxpayer would be the same. But the reason why it's horrible is that bondholders, you know, there's two different government entities, and they each have their own legal liabilities. And so for one government entity to pay another government entity's debts is a very, very dangerous
and precarious.
Nobody likes
that.
Bondholders hate that. And that could really jeopardize city debt ratings and make debt for the city of Chicago much higher. That is a possibility.
Let's take a quick break. Mike Fouché from AlderTrack is here. We're talking about fallout from yesterday's non-budget.
Right.
In the spring session, what got done. You know, we'll take a break, and then are there any positives to take from what happened in the spring session? There were a lot of bills, that the flurry of bills. We'll talk about it, though.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it here. Stay with us. It's a download. It's a download here on WGN Radio. Mike Fouché in studio with me from AlderTrack, covering all things Chicago and Springfield. Mike, let's talk about the flurry of bills, because it wasn't just the budget. Both the House and Senate were busy. They put some stuff together.
I think the big thing for the city of Chicago was the passage of the override of the veto of the police and fire pension reform. And to call it reform, you know, is really not the right thing to call it. It's essentially that it's as if the city took its mortgage for pensions and took it from a 30-year mortgage to a 40-year mortgage. They just extended the period.
And with that comes more interest.
With that comes more interest, but it also means less money that you have to put up front. And it's a huge deal for Chicago, because they save a lot of money. I think that if that failed, it would cost the city another $220 million right away, is what we had been hearing.
That was spectacular politics in the way that the governor vetoed this. And Rahm Emanuel came out. He came out guns blazing.
Yeah.
And the House responded. And some Republicans voted. Jumped on it.
And you know, good for you. I mean, because the thing that was actually pretty amazing about it is that Rahner was saying, oh, this is a terrible thing. This is horrible. But one of the things that was should be along with his ideology is that it allowed the city of Chicago in order to make decisions for itself about how it wanted to manage its finances. And I think a number of Republicans that voted for it saw that and made statements as.
And there's been a lot of kicking the can down the road talk. I've heard pretty much every Republican lawmaker talk that way or leader from both houses.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's different in the way that these are full payments. They're just spread out, so the money's a little bit less. I mean, we're going to pick up some of the interest, but the idea is that we're not taking – it's not the Blagojevich years. We're not back to taking 2 years off on this stuff.
No, we're not taking pension holidays. But the other thing is that there are so many cans lined up at this point. You basically take a step at any point, and you're going to kick a can down the road. That's how – hey, Metaphor City. And, you know, it's so bad. There's way more horrible things to come. And there's two other pension funds that the mayor needs to negotiate. He's getting close to negotiating a deal for the laborers' pension.
When we saw with the police and fire pensions, is that what politicians or lawmakers are going to go towards, the idea of refinancing essentially and trying to spread these out? Does that actually pass constitutional muster?
They think so. One of the things that was interesting about the state Supreme Court ruling, I think it was like March, is that the justices essentially said, well, you know, if this was negotiated, they left a big door open. If this is negotiated with the labor unions, then maybe we might be interested.
I see. Okay.
And so the thing that was special about the police fire pension deal is
it was negotiated.
It was negotiated, and the police and fire pensioners said, okay, cool, we're down with that.
And that's the case of what they're talking about
with the laborers right now. And there's another deal for state workers that's being talked about with AFSCME as well. So, you know, it could happen. It could move. Who knows? I mean, you know, I think the big thing is that everything is so incredibly toxic in the state house that even if you have something that's great, like this police fire thing, you know, that it is in danger of not passing, and it just barely
passed. Well, is there a point? I mean, obviously, the only thing we have as taxpayers is to vote. I mean, that's sort of our recourse, right?
Right.
But I mean, when politicians on both sides of the aisle are playing these big long game political fights, when they're doing strategy around politics and being able to stay in power. And, you know, it just seems like leaving in the wake of that is all of these people who need state services where, you know, this extra stress around whether or not schools are going to be funded, whether our kids will be there in September. I mean, it just feels like there's a huge drama being played out in Springfield and nobody wants to watch.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
like
everybody's
it should be canceled. Like
if it was
a drama, it should be canceled.
It's like in Brazil where they open up the guy's eyes and make him watch the whole thing. Yeah. I mean, there's no escaping this at this point. And the fight is essentially Bruce Rahner and his supporters believe that the state has been poorly fiscally managed and he's going to hold everybody to the fire until he makes them do the things that he believes needs to be done. And the Democrats are saying Bruce Rahner wants to make the state do things that nobody really wants to be done. And, you know, what's interesting is that this morning, Rahner, after all of the stuff that happened last night where the budgets didn't pass, Rahner went on a tour in the south part of the state. And he went from small town to small town to small town. Talking about how horrible the Chicago Democrats are.
And, you know, not to mention, which I thought was a very head-scratcher, and we had Senator Murphy on talking about it as well, was the idea that when the budget passed, the next day, or not passed, when the budget billed at Madigan-sponsored move to the Senate.
Right,
the next day, they were robocalling in some of those swing districts saying, these people voted to raise your taxes.
Right.
So it is – so the idea
we're
that
on
I hear
a full-on
from
– campaign
I hear from, from Christine Redonia, who was on Steve Cochran today, or you hear from Bruce Rauner, that they're ready to work and the Democrats are just all interested in power and politics. That's just not the case.
No, we're on full-on campaign mode. Both sides –
both sides.
Both sides are beating the crap out of each other. And, you know – I honestly, there. And what's also happening is that there's a major, major loss of trust, and there isn't, there are barely any kumbaya moments, you know, where people are going to be able to just kind of hold hands and laugh. And, you know, the speech that President Obama gave last fall, where he was talking about how everybody ought to remember that they can work together here in Springfield. And he remembered all the great times when he hung out with Republicans and played golf and whatever. That stuff is, it's not really having an effect. It's still happening, I'm told, but it's not the same.
Mike Fouché is the man behind AlderTrack, a subscription news site that covers all things Chicago and Springfield politics. Mike, good to see you. See you next week.
Great to be here.
All right. Coming up, we're going to talk with Allison Flowers. She's the author of The Exonerate Diaries. I'm very excited. The Exonerate Diaries, the fight for innocence, independence, and identity. She focuses and profiles four different exonerees, including Antoine Day, who is also here tonight. We're going to hear talk with Allison and Antoine, hear Antoine's story coming up here at the big table. Also coming up at in the 9 o'clock hour, Monica Eng and Louisa Chu will be here. The podcast Chewing. We'll talk a little food. Talk about the issue, McDonald's late-breaking story with Crane's reporting that McDonald's is looking to move to the old Harpo Studios in the West Loop, their headquarters, not a new McDonald's.
That would be an impressive McDonald's.
They're like, they're getting all this hubbub. We are opening a new McDonald's where Oprah once stood. No, but the headquarters.
Free Big Macs!
Big Macs. For participating McDonald's. That would not be a participating one. So free Big Macs somewhere else. It's the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up later in the show, Chris Gethard, a great comedian, is going to be at the AV Club Fest tomorrow at Talia Hall. We're going to talk with Chris about his career. He's a regular on Broad City on Comedy Central. He also has the Chris Gethard Show, which is great on Fusion, one of my favorite shows. We'll talk with Chris coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Also tonight, Monica Eng and Louisa Chu will be here. To talk about McDonald's. We'll also talk about Navy Pier, the 2.0 of Navy Pier with the new Ferris wheel. And we'll talk about third-party delivery services and how some chefs in Chicago are pushing back. They don't want them involved with their business, and how can they stop them from doing so? We'll have that conversation coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Well, you know what? It's always great to be called the capital of the country, the capital of the world, right? We're the hot dog capital of this country, regardless of what people say. But this one, Cook County has the most exonerations in the country, making it the wrongful conviction capital of the U.S. Imagine, if you will, being wrongfully convicted, trying to clear your name while spending time locked up. In Illinois alone, exonerees have lost over 1,700 years to prison. Let that sink in. 1,700 years. False accusations, mistaken IDs, false confessions, and official misconduct all play roles in putting the wrong people behind bars. A new book is out called The Exonerate Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity, and it's written by investigative journalist Allison Flowers. In the book, she profiles four exonerees, including Antoine Day, who spent almost 10 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. He was released in 2001. Tonight, it's my pleasure to welcome Allison Flowers and Antoine Day to the big table. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Great to see you. Thanks for being here. Allison, you've been working on, you know, you've spent a lifetime working on exonerees, the Exonerate Project. Talk about where this comes from, where this passion comes from to tell these stories.
Yeah, so I started looking into post-exoneration issues when I was working at the Medill Justice Project at Northwestern. And when I was in that role, I was on the front end. I was investigating potentially wrongful murder convictions. And, you know, that's really valuable work, of course. while I was doing that, it occurred to me one day as I was preparing to head into the office, you know, I just sort of stopped in my tracks and I thought, you know, we're doing all this work to uncover the truth, to help get innocent people out of prison. But what happens when those innocent people are freed? Where do they go? Mm-hmm. Who do they have in their lives anymore? And so I wanted to explore that question. And this was about almost 4 years ago. It really was one that, you know, just did not have enough attention at all. I did discover, however, that there was an innocence project here in the city at Loyola University called Life After Innocence, and it was dedicated to helping exonerees. And so I thought, okay, that's going to be my first stop for mm-hmm. looking at this question. And so I went over there and talked to Laura Caldwell, who heads up that program. She's a local author as well, law professor. And she introduced me to some exonerees. I started interviewing them, and suddenly I realized that this was really an unexplored terrain.
What happens after they get out, of the innocence movement.
You know, we're all familiar with DNA exonerations and sort of this victorious idea of getting out of prison, but there hadn't been much attention on what happens after.
Right, and you know, in the media, you'll see the big case that pops up and there'll be the press conference and an exoneree will be talking and maybe there'll be a lawsuit involved. But that's not the case with every time a conviction is overturned.
Right. It's really the exception, not the rule. So most exonerees are not compensated. And in fact, all exonerees are not compensated when they leave prison. So when you leave prison as an exoneree, there's no compensation. That's automatic anyway. There's no expungement, so your record shows that you have a murder conviction or whatever it is that you were wrongly convicted of. And, you know, beyond that, your family members may have moved on. Your spouse probably has divorced you. Your children don't know you anymore. You can't get a job and provide for yourself, let alone a family. So, you know, it's really not an ending. That's where the prison movies end, right, is when the mm-hmm. person gets out of prison. It's really not an ending. It's not a Hollywood thing at all. It's really just the beginning.
Allison, why choose the four exonerees that you chose to profile in this book?
Well, I wanted to choose exonerees from Cook County. And the three men that are in the book are from Cook County. I decided to include a woman in the fray. She's actually from Indiana, but lives in Cook County. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to focus on Cook County because, as you mentioned, it's the wrongful conviction capital of the U.S. It has the highest number of exonerations, about 123 out of the 160 that Illinois has thereabouts. It is, well, Harris County, Texas is kind of trailing right behind at 118. So I think it's a title that we would be very willing to relinquish. But I wanted to focus on that. And also the four people that I chose are so different. Their cases are different. It shows different flaws mm-hmm. in the criminal justice system. You know, one exoneree was wrongly convicted on a mistaken eyewitness identification, another because of perjury, another because of bad arson science. And so I wanted to highlight the flaws in the system through their cases, but also put a name and a face.
You know, when you talk about percentages and numbers, are there certain causes that are higher than others? I mean, you've mentioned a lot right there, but are there some that you're always like, oh, false confession always is what they point to. What are the number one causes?
Right. So we have something now called the National Registry of Exonerations. It's developed just in the last couple of years, and it's sort of the official tracker of exonerations since 1989. So, of course, a lot is lost in the shuffle, and there's no way to really alert, you know, the tracker when someone has had their case mm-hmm. overturned. So you basically have to hunt for these cases, but they've gotten really good at it. And so there's about an exoneration every 3 days in this country. And so the exoneration registry is just growing and growing. And so by tracking those, you can, of course, look at those cases and see what they have in common and see what the patterns and trends are. And what it shows is that the leading cause of wrongful convictions, as seen in these, you know, 1,800 or so exonerations, is actually perjury or false accusation. So that's just when someone, you know, believes a rumor or has some sort of incentive to lie about you in court and they testify against you on the stand. So oftentimes when exonerees are released, it's because of a recantation. The witness has taken it back. You know, there's other contributing factors as well. There's Mistaken ID, as I mentioned, that's in about a third of cases. There's false confession. Cook County is also the false confession capital of the U.S., something to be proud of. 13% of cases of exonerations involve a false confession.
Right.
There's misleading or bad science or forensics. That's in about a quarter of cases. And then more than half of cases involve some sort of official misconduct.
And that's a big part of Cook County. We've seen that with the cases involving John Burge and torture cases and other things that we've seen over the years where there have been false confessions and official misconduct.
Right. And, you know, that's obviously a very timely issue here in Chicago. New data at the Invisible Institute where I work shows that, you know, 97% of police misconduct complaints go undisciplined. And I think there's a very strong link between police misconduct and wrongful convictions, as we see in these exoneration trends.
The book is called The Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Antoine Day, who is one of the profiled exonerees in the book, is here in studio. I want to hear your story, Antoine. I want to hear not only just about, you know, what put you in prison, but also what it was like in there, knowing that you didn't commit the crime and what life has been like after. Antoine Day, also Allison Flowers. And you can see Allison and the exonerees are going to be at Loyola University's Law School, 25 East Pearson, tomorrow night at 6 o'clock. Are you going to – the exonerees will be there, all four?
Yes, all four will be there for Q&A. I'll be doing a talk as well, and it's open and free to the public.
That's coming up tomorrow. All right, stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight at the big table, the author of The Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. Allison Flowers is an investigative journalist. You can catch her tomorrow night at Loyola University Law School, 25 East Pearson, at 6 o'clock. She will be speaking and also presenting the book and also the exonerees who will be there, including Antoine Day, who is featured in the book, and he's also in studio with us tonight. Antoine, let's turn to you. The best way to organize this is just tell your story. So let's pick up on that night that was in front of the liquor store back in, what was that, 1990?
90, yeah.
Yeah.
So incident occurred in front of the liquor store, and there was some guys gambling, and said somebody came up to rob the dice game. So it was a shooting, and three people were shot. I think it was three people were shot. And so, you know, it was a big fuss about, you know, who did it.
Now, you weren't there.
No.
Never. But the rumor mill.
Right, the rumor mill.
The next day and the days after were checkout.
Yeah. Well, the incident occurred. How Twan name got involved was a vehicle. I had a black Chevy Blazer. And at first they said it was a black deuce and a quarter. Then they said it was a black station wagon. Then it was a black Blazer. Well, hey, Twan got a black Blazer. So, and of which that was parked in front of my house at the time, wasn't even running. So, things just started occurring, and so when I found out the police wanted to question me, I went into the police station. I didn't run. They didn't track me down like an animal. I went into the police station trusting that, you know, this can be handled right. Mm-hmm. So I sat in a room with an eyewitness who I spoke to over 45 minutes, never knew who he was, and he didn't know who I was. We had a conversation. And we were maybe 5 or 6 feet away from one another, just holding a conversation for about 45 minutes.
And then it went to a lineup.
Yeah. So they came in. They said, you ready to stand in lineup? I said, yeah. And he was the witness, and I was the guy going in the lineup.
Were you at all at this point, and it's hard to think back because we're talking about, you know, years ago now. Were you at all at that point, like, was your antenna up that you're like, this is kind of weird that I've been in the police station for this long and now they want me to be in a lineup? I mean, what was going through your head at that
time? Yeah, it was definitely weird because, I know how they operate in this community. So it was definitely a weird situation. And
on the west side of Chicago.
Yeah, on the west side of Chicago in Austin area. So being in a situation, I just trusted in it, you know, that they couldn't pick me out because I didn't do anything. So here it is, you got a heroin addict who would have said his mom killed Kennedy if caught in that situation, you know, and this guy picked me out. And police put a lot of pressure on those guys, you know, and you know, and then when they came and told me that I was positive, it was a positive ID, and I'm like, wow, what? He said it was a positive ID, so they arrested me. So at that point, I ended up going through the system.
Let me, I mean, I don't want to give away the whole chat. I mean, your story is so compelling in the book, and it's a great read about how, you know, lawyers, changing lawyers, how everything kind of play. I mean, there's so much there. We're not going to get to everything.
Okay.
But obviously, when you're in the courtroom and the judge says, you know what, I'm going to get you, you're convicted on murder, attempted murder, and there was another charge,
unlawful
use of a weapon.
A lot of other
what goes through your head knowing that you just got concurrent, a 60-year concurrent sentence?
Well, you know, I mean, it's it was so unreal. I had no emotions. You know how they said he showed he had no.
Like
he didn't show any remorse. You know, it's not that. It's that you're in such a shock. You can't even cry if you wanted to cry. You're really searching for the breath to say, hey, this is the wrong person. You know, you guys got the wrong person. So, I mean, it's really hard, man, because all I could do is just stare at him and look at my mom, you know, and felt like I needed to apologize to my mother for, you know, dragging her through this. And I mean, it was really hard, you know, emotionally. So I dealt with it, you know, and I tried to keep my sanity. But it's rough how the system can really rip your life apart and you not even know it.
Well, I mean, there's still so much to talk about with this story. Let's talk about your time in prison. I mean, going and you were in Pontiac
and Stateville.
Let's talk about it. I mean, at the first parts of it, you were a little bit, I guess, right? I wouldn't know how anyone would act if you didn't do the crime, but you were, I guess, what you would say, quote unquote, trouble in the way that you were fighting in prison. Mm-hmm. The guard, you know, you had sort of a lack of respect.
Right.
Where did that come from for you?
Well, that came, you know, really with the trust factor, you know what I'm saying? And I felt like I had to build this defense up against everybody. It wasn't just the guards. It was other inmates and, you know, just people in general, to where I really tried to isolate myself, you know, because I had no trust. And it was a terrible way to look at people who hadn't done anything to you. But going through this system of prejudice and a lot of murders and rapes in this institution, it was so many things going on, and it was so fast, you know. You couldn't wait to go to sleep. Sleep didn't last long enough, you know, and the things you would hear and things you would see inside of these walls, man, it was just, it gave you a lot to deal with. So I had a rough time, you know,
adjusting
adjusting and dealing with people in general, mostly with the guards, because they would come in. I was a little jealous. They would come in every day from home. They would leave at a certain hour and go home to their families. And I'm sitting here looking at pictures, and then I'm violated because they'll come in and they'll take those personal things and sling them on the floor, put them in the toilet, you know, things like that, just to upset you, you know. So at a point, you have to get inside your head and not let them control you. So that's what I did.
Psychologically, you know, at what point, you know, knowing that, you know, you're wrongly convicted, at what point psychologically do you make the decision to continue to fight or to say, this is my surroundings, this is my life?
I never gave up. From the day that they sentenced me, I knew that I'll be back. I knew that I was going to get that case overturned, because I truly feel in my heart that the truth overweighs a lie any day. So I really knew in my heart that I would come home. I knew it was going to take a fight. I had to stay determined. But sometime I would lose that. Right. I would lose that. Right. I would say, I'm just wishful thinking. You know, I'm not going nowhere. So that would begin to turn you into a different type of animal. Now it's the survival game, you know, because people try to, they attack you every day, you know, and it's so hard sometimes, really, just to go in your head now to think about, you know, how you had to prepare yourself every day, because every day that I was in Pontiac for 4 straight years, somebody was stabbed, beat, or killed. I done seen a couple of people shot by guards in the institution. Brains blown out, one shot, and killed him. You know, no warning shots. You don't get those. You get kill shots. So I've seen that so often. I've seen so many bodies land in the shower, stabbed up. You know, people beat where they couldn't see. They lost their eyesight because the bone structure has been smashed so bad. So I've seen so many things, man, to where I really had to get on my knees and pray that I don't become one of these animals. Because it's really a vicious cycle when you're in there and you're learning how to deal. And I was still adjusting to it.
Antoine Day was exonerated in 2001. So he spent almost 10 years in prison. I mean, what we're talking about right here is, 4 years. You just summed up 4 years at Pontiac. I mean, there's even six more years of the sentence. We'll continue the conversation after the news. Allison Flowers is the author of The Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. And one of the featured and profiled exonerees is Antoine Day, and he's in studio telling his story. When we come back, we've got to talk about what it felt like and what happened after you got out.
Oh, sure.
We'll continue the conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Allison Flowers. Her new book, The Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity is out. Congratulations on the book. I know you've been working on it for a while.
Thank you.
You can see her tomorrow night at Loyola University Law School, which is over 25 East Pearson, right over here, Chicago Pearson, essentially, or right in that area, at 6 p.m. And also Antoine Day, who's featured in the book. And we'll continue our conversation with you, Antoine, because, mm-hmm. you know, we talked about all the sort of things that were really negative experiences for you to be in jail, especially in wrongfully convicted. I mean, to be able to hold out hope that one day you'd get out. Music played a big role in keeping you sane.
Yeah, music, you know, music is my life. So music was my escape. You know, and because growing up, I listened to Super CFL, you know, Wee FM, you know, I rocked, I countryed, I did it all. So music was my way out to get rid of the stress every day, you know. So I pretty much would sleep with my ear, my headphones on, my earplugs in. And I was given an opportunity in prison to create this band. It was called the Power Soul Band. And this band was all the guys who was incarcerated, you know, who were musicians. Because it was a lot going on. It was a lot of fighting and riots and mm-hmm. stuff going on. So I got a chance to talk with a superintendent, Superintendent Kelly, who was a really, really great guy. And he believed in giving you an opportunity, you know, to do something with your time. So he did. He gave us an opportunity to create this band. So I would go around and ask guys, and they was excited, man. So a lot of stuff didn't continue to take place as far as incidents and police stabbings and guys fighting and stuff. You know, it kind of dissipated for a while, you know.
Yeah, right.
But that was my out. And music is what I do today. Just keeping me level, keeping me on an even keel. You know.
Let's move the conversation. I mean, like I said before, this is a great story. Your story mm-hmm. is tremendous read, and there's a lot of aspects. So let's jump.
If I tell it all.
No. Yeah, no. Let's jump to the point where you're in the courtroom, mm-hmm. and the judge says, "Free to go."
Oh wow! Yeah, he asked me a question though, and I love to tell this part. He said, "Mr. Day, you have any?" He said, "Are you ready to go home?" You know, I had the wonderful lawyer. Let me not forget about Joseph Howard, who was the best, the Jewish man who I love to death. You know, he came in and told me he was my lawyer. I didn't ask for him. He took my case. And he told me one thing he wanted me to do is pay attention to my case and stay positive. And that's what I did. So when we made it, and every time we went to court, the state's attorneys would laugh at him. They would make jokes about him. And he would look at me.
Because of the way he looked.
Yeah, the way he walked. You know, yeah. he kind of reminded you of Columbo. He come in, you know, his feet was bad, so he'll walk up. He was old, man. He was like 77 then, I believe. And he came in, and every time we go to court, he said, "Are you ready to go home? Did you bring some clothes?" You know, and it was a joke because after the joke, you know, I would go back into the jail, and there I go again for another year, 6, 7, 8, 9 months, however long, until one, this one day, we didn't even know. He never asked the question. And then the judge asked me, he said, Mr. Dale, are you ready to go home today? I was knocked off my feet because my mom didn't know, he didn't know, I didn't know.
It was unexpected, right? How often does that happen, Allison? I think in my head it's a huge media circus. Mm-hmm. People are ready. Everyone's there. Everybody's in their Sunday best. They're ready to, is this going to be it? You're free to go. But that's not how it works.
That's not how it works at all. I would say that most exonerees don't know that it's coming, or they're given maybe 24 hours notice. And of course, that 24 hours when you're about to leave the jail becomes a really dangerous time. You know, you don't want to mess it up, and the prison doesn't want you to get hurt either, because then suddenly you're a liability to them. But yeah, most of the time, exonerees don't have much notice. The exonerees featured in the book, none of them had notice, other than, waiting a new trial, perhaps, or being at mm-hmm. county jail, and some indication that it could be. But after, you know, in Antoine's case, he was behind bars for almost 10 years. The other exonerees, 17 years, 21 years, 24 years, collectively 80 years behind bars, just with these four exonerees. So, of course, they've seen numerous appeals over the years and lots of disappointments where they did not go home.
For you, I mean, you mentioned, Antoine, you mentioned your lawyer. I mean, how, Allison, from your investigations and your reporting and the stories that you're telling about, not just these four, but the exonerees, how important is it that lawyer that just says, you know what, I want to take this case for justice. There's no real paycheck in this. This is about justice.
It's everything. You know, the exonerees in the book, they really are extraordinary because they beat remarkable odds. It's extremely rare to overturn a wrongful conviction. Rob Warden, who's, you know, kind of famous here in the innocence world here in Chicago, started the Center on Wrongful Convictions. He says that, it takes serendipity, really, for a case to be overturned. So it's extremely rare. It does require a lot of good Samaritans along the way who are willing to help. Two of the exonerees in the book are former clients of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern.
Right.
Antoine's case is a little different, though, because it was actually a real estate lawyer who took an interest in his case and, you know, had never done this type of thing before.
And that's why they were snickering in the courtroom. They're like, usually not in this situation. Good
right.
Lord. Right.
He wore moccasins and he would shuffle into the courtroom at 26 in California. So I'm sure it was quite the sight. But, he had never taken a case like this before. And he just kind of believed in Antoine and took up his cause.
Helson, half of this book is about everything that we've talked to up to this point. But the other half is about how people adjust after. No one really takes a look at what happens. So Antoine, back to your story. You're free to go. What happens? I mean, obviously the details are so well written. The idea of putting on someone else's clothes, walking out, wow, hitching a ride, trying to get back to your mom's house in the West Side. But past the details that you can read in Allison's book, what was going through your head, you know, out of jail for the first time in 10 years, what were you facing?
What do I do now? How do I make it? There was nothing. Actually, the state kept $48 of my money, so I had no money to get on the bus. Absolutely nothing, you know, and I had to figure it all out, which is, I think, is totally unfair. Like Alice said, It's unfair for them to know that they wronged you and then do nothing, just let you go, you know. So if it wasn't for my family and people like Allison, people like Mr. Howard, to step up and say, hey, let's do something about this. Let's tell somebody. Because if you don't tell it, it'll happen over and over and over and over again. And one of the things I really realize now is that most of these state's attorneys that was wrongfully prosecuting people are turning into judges now. It's kind of scary, you know, to think that, we have gotten that far. We're not thinking about who it was that did this, because it's not just the police.
Is that a part of your healing? I mean, the psychological sort of idea of justice, and it's such a warped concept in your case, because, you know, justice served and wrongfully convicted, but the concept of having some sort of justice for someone who went out of their, you can make the argument, went out of their way to convict you.
Right. And it is. Just being able to talk about it is justice for me. You know, so I don't walk around angry. You know, I don't walk around bitter. None of that.
Was it hard at the first? Was it hard not to sort of say, look at how society wronged me. I'll just play the victim.
No, I never did that. You know, I don't think I was cut from that cloth because I'm a doer. And I knew that I had a fight on my hand. You know, I had to fight. Some things you got to fight for. Says if it's worth having, it's worth fighting for. And my life was worth fighting for. So I don't walk around with the bitterness, none of that. I just want to let people know that we see it now. You can't do something like this to a person and hide it. You can't steal somebody's life and kidnap them and then say there's nothing you can do about it. You know? So, yeah, it's difficult. So what Allison is doing for this country is getting his word out, letting people know that these things are going on. So most people only think they happen to somebody else.
Right.
But it happens to so many people, and you'd be surprised.
Allison, you know, for exonerees that you've interviewed, that you've worked with in your time as a reporter, how, I mean, are they similar stories? I mean, it seems like the resolve that Antoine's talking about would be shared, but it also, I feel like psychologically, it's a lot to overcome being in jail for 10, 15, 20, 25 years.
Of course. I mean, I think when you talk to an exoneree like Antoine and the others, I think ultimately they don't want anger and bitterness to have any more real estate in their lives. They don't want to waste the years that they have left on those emotions. But I think you can obviously, once you start talking to them, the frustration and about the injustice that they faced is still there. And I think it's a burden that doesn't really go away. You know, there's no counseling, no social services for exonerees. But when they leave prison, many are experiencing, symptoms of PTSD like a war veteran does. And yet, sure. You know, they're not even, you know, given a bus pass to get home safely to their families.
Does what Allison is saying, it resonates?
Hey, I can't say it any better, you know. So and it's so true because the trauma is so internal. You can't see it. Everybody think you walk around and you hating people. That's not what it is. Some people have they withdraw. You know, we have a lot of people right now that's suffering and asking for help. We come out with from the state, we come out with a mental issue. A health, physical issue, because a lot of guys got diabetes, their kidneys, their livers failing, dental, eyes, you know, and you come home with nothing. You come home with nothing. Nobody's standing in line to say, hey, let us help you with that. Let us help you with that. Nobody. So a lot of the situations is some of these guys end up on the street because there's no housing. If you're on parole, you got an option to get housing. But if you just exoneree,
yeah,
you're just in the street.
We'll see you later, right?
So now they're trying to make put things in place for exonerated people.
You've chosen to work in the field to give back. I mean, you have set up foundations and work with not only exonerees but kids in areas. So talk about why you give back. I mean, I'm interested in the psychological approach to being wrongfully convicted. And then feeling like, you know, you want to give back to a society that wronged you.
So giving back to me is helping somebody help themselves. You know, like when Mr. Joe gave me, he just gave. It wasn't a question why. He just gave. And that's how I give back to the community. Because right now I'm at Better Boys and Girls Foundation, where I'm helping youth and adults, because we run a reentry program as well. I help them with employment. I help them with education. We help them with mental illness.
Do they know your story?
Yeah, most of them. Some of them, you know, said, you know, they didn't see me on TV. They didn't hear it on the radio, you know, different things. But not all of them know it. But and you know, sometime when we have groups, we'll talk about where we came from and where we're going. So my thing is how I overcome being frustrated anymore is helping somebody else find success in their lives. That's what matters to me. Hmm. You know, and to get this story out and tell people, you don't have to sit in your funk. You know, you don't have to sit in it. You can shake it off, you can move forward, you can get your life together. And that way I fight what they thought they were going to do to me, how they thought they were going to destroy me, they didn't. So I can help other people save their lives.
Allison, what usually happens to exonerees? You talk about every 3 days in this country. What's the usual course, if there is one, from the data of what happens to exonerees once they're out?
Well, once they're out, you know, they struggle to find jobs. Hopefully they have some family member who can take them in. One exoneree that you'll meet in the book, James Kleppelberg, you know, his lawyers were looking into halfway houses for him without much luck. And he was staying at a hotel temporarily when his estranged son came forward after seeing some of the media attention around his case and invited him into his home. And, you know, his little girls gave up their bed and this, you know, kind of bulky, hulking guy sat, you know, slept on a Tinkerbell bed. But, you know, that's the exception. Many of them end up homeless. You know, in Antoine's case, you know, sleeping at times on his mother's sofa, kind of being in between things a lot of the time. There are about 30 states, Illinois included, and D.C., that do provide compensation to exonerees. So there's 20 states that don't. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even among the states that do have some sort of policy or law to compensate an exoneree, those laws still fall short. You know, in Illinois, the most you can be compensated is about $200,000 for a wrongful conviction, depending on the length of time. So for some of these guys in the book, 21 years, 24 years, that's not even $10,000 a year. Mm-hmm. You know, for your wrongful conviction. And on top of that, you actually have to go through another legal process. You have to find a lawyer who can represent you to prove your innocence again to the court. So if you recall, like, you know, at an original trial, it's, you know, not guilty, right? But in this case, you're having to actually prove your innocence, which after a lengthy incarceration is very difficult to, you know, pull up old witnesses who may be... have passed away,
this
right, or don't want to talk.
This is just to get the money?
This is just to get the money. You have to prove your innocence all over again. You know, evidence may be destroyed, so it's difficult to prove innocence, and it's a different standard of proof than what's required at trial.
Antoine, I'll give you the last word here. Listening to Allison, you know, being a part of this project, obviously sharing your stories. Mm-hmm. How does it make you feel after all these years, especially the 10 years that you lost in prison, to be sitting in this studio on Michigan Avenue telling your story?
Great. It feels great to be able to speak about it, to have somebody like Allison to really talk about it, because I could never just say it the way she said. And the book really says, I mean, she's so in-depth in the book that, you know, she dug into all of us and got the story. But it's great to sit here and talk about it, because this is something that a lot of people never thought would happen. So I'm glad to turn the table and say, hey, here it is. You know, you can't hide justice forever, you know, because love, truth, peace, freedom, and justice is what we live by. And I love Allison to death, Hunter's new baby, hers, and hope he'll be able to tell the same stories his mom tells, because this is a gift. And I adore her and her husband, man. And, you know, and she's so empowering. You know, I want to talk about her mom and the whole family, but Allison is this book is a read. It's for somebody to take home, get your nice bottle of wine, sit by the fireplace and read, because this will show you how society has to change.
The book is called The Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. It's written by investigative journalist Allison Flowers. It also features the story of Antoine Day, who was wrongfully convicted for about 10 years. Antoine, Allison, thanks for being my guest tonight.
Thanks for having us.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Allison Flowers, Antoine Day. That was great, and the book is great, and I we only had an hour. It's nights like this, Pete, where I'm always like, well, maybe we should do 2 hour segments. We didn't have enough time for Antoine to tell his story, which is a tremendous story. You can see Antoine and the other exonerees over at Loyola University Law School tomorrow night, 6:00, 25 East Pearson. Allison Flowers will be there with her book as well. Shifting gears, big breaking news tonight that McDonald's is thinking about moving their headquarters to the West Loop, to the old Harpo complex that Oprah Winfrey made famous in the West Loop. We'll talk about McDonald's. We'll talk about Navy Pier. And we'll talk about third-party delivery, which I'm fascinated by. I'm fascinated. Louisa Chu, Monica Anger here, the podcast Chewing. That's coming up right after the news. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later, Chris Gethert's going to be here. New York comedian, hilarious, from the Upright Citizens Brigade. He's performing at the AV Club Festival, which is at Talia Hall. Chris Gethert has also been on This American Life. He's got his own podcast. He's in the show Broad City, which is on Comedy Central, and he's part of the new Mike Birbiglia movie, which is coming out. It's getting all the rage. He'll be coming up a little bit later in the show. Also tonight, Picnic. This is, of course, our movement here on the download to give every player, coach, manager, equipment manager, all down the line for the Chicago Cubs, 2016 Chicago Cubs, a legitimate, authentic nickname.
Nice.
So that's what we're going with. Last week, we had a really good one. Pedro Strop, who's the setup man, his new nickname is White Castle because he has the best sliders in the business.
I approve.
Addison Russell, who's a shortstop for the Cubs, his nickname is Smooth Criminal, mostly because it's criminal how smooth he is on the diamond.
Know nothing about that.
And then you could do you could play that song as a walk-up song. Dexter Fowler, who's a center fielder, he's free range. That's your play right into you guys.
Oh, my gosh. GMO free.
So tonight, Ben Zobrist. Second baseman, outfielder, utility, all around. He could play anywhere.
Yeah.
Ben Zobrist. That's our nickname choice for tonight. 312-981-7200. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. We're giving away a pizza for whoever gets the win.
Multi-use utensil? I'm thinking that's going to stick.
Multi-use utensil.
Very catchy.
Yes. Two of my favorite people in the world are in studio with us now. Louisa Chu, Monica Eng, the podcast Chewing, which you can get on iTunes and also at the ChicagoTribune.com. Coming up this week, they're releasing a new episode called Bits, Bites, and Barbecue, just in time for Father's Day. Monica, Louisa are in studio tonight to talk about McDonald's. We'll talk about Navy Pier, and we'll talk about the third-party delivery systems when it comes to food. Louisa, Monica, great to see you guys.
Great to see you too, Justin. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, no. Why don't we start with McDonald's? The rumor Cranes is reporting that they're in final stages to move the headquarters from Oak Brook down to the West Loop here in Chicago. It's a huge game. I mean, we don't know if it's going to happen, but it's a huge move. That's a huge campus out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a retreat. I was there for a conference, and you know, do you stay at the hotel or do you go to the retreat room or do you go to the museum where they have all this memorabilia, which is actually very, very cool. I don't like to promote brands,
but I have to say, it sounds like a little staycation you had, Monica.
I was taking pictures of all of these old little, you know, McDonald's insignias and the hats they used to wear. And stuff
I think there's a lot to be said, too, as far as like the business side is concerned. I mean, the way it started out was pretty ingenious. I mean, they started out by really standardizing food at a time that it wasn't so easy to travel wherever you go and get like a good meal. So, yeah, I kind of go for the historic aspect of it.
But I wonder how they could really move the whole thing.
Maybe it's just the headquarters. Maybe when they say headquarters, they specifically mean just the
corporate part of it.
But you know, McDonald's has been in the news last week. They had their annual meeting. There were a lot of protests in front of the meeting, both inside and outside the actual buildings. Really, a myriad topic, but the big one was the fight for minimum wage.
Yeah.
How did that play out? I mean, is that just a normal thing now for retail or fast food giants? Whenever they have their annual meeting, people protest in front of it?
The fight for 15 pretty much emerges whenever there's an opportunity to go after a big organization that, you know, still has minimum wage workers. So that was pretty predictable, and we kind of knew that was going to happen. Some of the more unique and strange aspects that McDonald's is being criticized for include this film that that was being toured around to different middle schools and high schools around the nation about an Iowa teacher who had eaten McDonald's for months and lost 60 pounds. And he also was walking a lot every day.
But the idea being that the diet was a McDonald's diet, and therefore he lost food, and kinda he's like going to teach you how.
The anti-supersize me.
Right.
And so people were, you know, pretty up in arms. They said, what are you doing? You're having this guy, this teacher, go around and tell these kids you can eat McDonald's every day, and boy, you'll just lose all these pounds and shed all this weight. So that was quietly put to bed. And then the second teacher...
By who? What do you mean by...
By McDonald's.
McDonald's, you know, is like, all right, let's just make this film. They can make films disappear?
Well, we're going to have this guy stop touring okay, on our behalf, and we're going to stop distributing the video and handing out this informational...
Right. So it was really a corporate move. Yeah. Less when you say this film, it wasn't like an independent filmmaker who's like, I made this documentary about this guy. No, this was a McDonald's sort of promotional
Well, he made film. He made the documentary and did the experiment sort of on his own, but then McDonald's picked him up, and Louisa, of course, is saying she's going to make a documentary about how Popeye's chicken makes her healthy.
Right, and dress up as a drumstick, you know, and have them send me around the
well,
U.S.
Well, so the dressing up part is, so this other very controversial aspect of McDonald's marketing to kids is something called McTeacher's Nights. And I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw a flyer for it for Moo Elementary School on California near North Avenue in Chicago. And it had a teacher literally dressed as a pie. Her little hands are sticking out of the sides of the pie. And teachers go and they work behind the counter at McDonald's for the night and encourage their students to come and buy food. And a portion of those proceeds will go to the school.
And the problem with that, and this is what protesters and critics will say, is that, you know, the public schools and schools have enough trouble trying to teach kids to be healthy with their food choices.
Right.
McDonald's is not doing good things necessarily for the community by giving back cash. They're just trying to promote their brand.
Right. And then having the teachers put their imprimatur, like, I am the authority figure and I tell you what's good and bad. And if I'm behind the counter, how bad can this be?
Yeah. And wait a minute. Let's not skim over the fact that there was a teacher dressed as a pie.
Right.
As like,
as if they're not humiliated enough at school.
That's insane.
Get in that pie costume.
Exactly.
I know they didn't want to wear that.
They're dressed like a pie mascot. I mean, I think that there's lots of arguments that we've heard from colleagues, you know, very learned colleagues about the benefits, but why have teachers dress up as a pie mascot?
It makes it more fun, Louisa.
Well,
right. I have to say, one of my colleagues in public radio, she's also a CPS mom on the north side, and she came up to me, she said, holy moly, if this ever happened at my school, the parents would go crazy. And then another colleague who has her kids more on the south side said, what, are you kidding? I organized one of these at my school, and people in my neighborhood eat at McDonald's, and we need the money for our school, so why are you being so high and mighty?
So it really comes, I mean, I guess with that, I mean, is McDonald's aggressively pursuing schools with this, or is this something that, you know, parents, for fundraising purposes, some will say, let's do a candy bar deal, let's do a popcorn, let's do a cookie dough, let's do a McDonald's night. Like, how's it work?
That's fairly unclear, because when I asked McDonald's about this, they said, oh, no, this is up to the franchisees. They do it. And then they backtracked and they sent me information saying that the McDonald's Corporation, not the franchisees, has given X amount of dollars this year to schools through this. And I said, wait, I thought you said this was all franchisees. Now you're, so it seems like it's both the core McDonald's owned stores and the franchisees who are doing it. And yeah, the parents can reach out to them.
Well, I mean, let me play devil's advocate for just a second, in the sense that it does raise money for the school. I mean, that's what
I'm
it's
sure
trying
it
to
does.
Do, and McDonald's is offering that. I know the issues involved, especially when it comes to nutrition and education and those kind of things. But at the end of the day, you know, earlier in this show, we were talking about public schools don't have any money.
Right. And so I can see my colleague's point of view. You know, the school's underfunded. They're going to eat at McDonald's anyway. So why not have the teacher dress up as a pie?
That's the part that I really have a problem with. Because as we've discussed this previously, I don't dislike McDonald's. I eat McDonald's occasionally. You know, every once in a while, you can get the breakfasts, hash browns are fantastic. Get them. Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Extra well
the
done.
Life
or,
hacks of Louisa
right,
Chu.
Exactly. Yeah. Or get the, you know, granola yogurt parfait. Excellent. There are healthy choices there. However, the big red flag, I just, again, to me, I don't understand the pie costume, you know, because we do understand that there's serious underfunding. Remember back in the day we used to have birthday parties at McDonald's and they were an innocent time? But this is something else.
It just feels like there's a teacher's lounge somewhere where they're like, well, we're down to 2,500. All right.
Looks like it's McTeacher's nighttime.
Get the pie.
Get the pie costume
out. Get the pie.
Is it the new strawberries and creme pie costume?
Oh, I kind of wanted to buy one of those
tonight. No.
This is devolving. Louisa Chu, Monica Eng, the podcast Chewing. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and let's talk Navy Pier, the 2.0 version of Navy Pier. Mm-hmm. Saw all the news about the Ferris wheel over the weekend. Let's talk about all the other changes that have happened at the pier. It's The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. In studio with me, Monica Eng, Louisa Chu. I said that backwards. It's chewing.
Right.
That's Louisa Chu, Monica
Eng. I
should
go first.
You can find their podcast. A new episode drops this Friday. Bits, Bites, and Barbecues, just in time for Father's Day. You can find it at Chicago Tribune or on iTunes. We just talked about McDonald's. Let's talk about Navy Pier. A lot of the news obviously focused on this huge new Ferris wheel.
Yeah.
But, you know, this has been being done in phases where they're changing everything from the rides, the entertainment, the style, the aesthetic, and,
the fountain,
of course,
and the
food.
Park in front.
Right.
Of course,
yeah.
The food, most importantly for us. But, yeah, Ferris wheel. You went on it, Monica?
I did. I went on a very ultra secret preview embargoed ride more than a week ago.
Well,
and,
the perks of being you.
And the air conditioning wasn't working yet. So at our first revolution around, we're all pressing our face against the glass saying, please let us out. We're baking in here. And then finally the air conditioning kicked in. But I understand it's working now, although they did have that bit of a fiasco.
The power outage on the first day,
20-minute,
right?
Yeah, 20-minute power outage. That could be scary.
We'll let that slide.
Well, you know, I'm sure the marketing is an extended ride, you know?
And, you know, the Polk Brothers Park and Fountain and Plaza was supposed to open that first day, the $19 million park in front.
What?
You know, and it was kind of just fine before they tore it all up.
That's the one that had the cool fountains that were at the front.
Yeah, like the interactive fountains. Yeah. And then they tore that up and put in a new fountain. That was supposed to open up the first day, so last Friday as well. It didn't quite. The fountain's open. The plaza is still being worked on.
Spoiler
and then the
alert.
Family pavilion was supposed to be redone. That's the pavilion where the Children's Museum is, where McDonald's is. That had to be put on hold for several months, too. But they do have the new water fountain, and they do have a lot of cool new restaurants.
Yeah, so we did a new food guide at ChicagoTribune.com of the new food. So, you know, you guys know sort of the classic food. I mean, of course.
Well, they had McDonald's there forever. They had the Billy Goat, which is their Riva restaurant.
Still there.
Then all of the sort of the more... knockoff
Reba's fudge.
Yeah,
like Aunt Annie's pretzels.
Well, the place they brought Jamba Juice and Aunt Annie's in later, but when the pier first opened, and I only know it from hearsay from being in the building,
legend,
that they said that McDonald's had such a clause that they wouldn't let brands in. So that's why there wasn't a Starbucks. That's why there was. It was all like Marbucks.
The Gyros guy.
Yeah, exactly. The Gyros guy. Like it was not.
McDonald's.
Yeah.
Right?
It was all because McDonald's was like.
I didn't know that.
Again, that this is all the guy behind the counter at Carnelli's going. Let me tell you something. Yeah. So I don't know.
Always a great source.
Yeah, always a great source. Yeah.
But they did bring franchises in later. But they do have some independent things. So some of the new stuff are three Let Us Entertain You places, Frankie's Pizzeria, Big Bowl Light, sort of
Big Bowl
mini
Express,
version.
Yeah,
and
which I like.
Big City Chicken,
yeah, which
is
I
Nashville
like.
Hot,
right? Exactly. So I had a chance to eat through quite a bit of it for the guide, and so I have to say that the Frankie's Pizza there is pretty decent. You know, I mean, it's kind
we
of
had
like
it tonight.
We did. We split a slice. And it's kind of like, you know, the bigger Neapolitan-inspired slice, you know. So pretty decent. I would say that the way to sort of hack that a little bit is get them to warm it up a little bit, you know, and actually maybe drizzle a little bit of jardinera on there. But the Big Bowl Express.
They do always warm it up.
Yeah.
It's a good dough.
It's
$4.95 for a cheese slice.
Yeah, and for pier prices, while that sounds kind of like a lot for a slice, it's a pretty big, hearty slice. And, it's actually one of the things that's really worth it. And then the Big Bowl Express... My trick to that, too, then, is so they give you like an oval container, get the rice on the bottom and the stuff on top. And then off season, one of the things I liked about being there, like in the middle of December or February, is that they can do custom food. So a lot of times I had them do like, say, you know, like a custom deep fried broccoli or something, you know, I mean, and they're really good about making special orders. Now, maybe not so much because it's starting to get really busy.
Well, this is the busy time now after Memorial Day. Is the pier ready for the tourism? For the, I mean, you said that the front fountain may not be done
yet.
Right,
the Polk Brothers Fountain.
But the other stuff is up, and they're already said they're going to sort of punt on the family pavilion for a little bit. But, I mean, is it ready? I like the aesthetic design of the pier in the sense that they opened up the outside to make it a much more palatable experience for tourists and people who have to navigate tourists.
Yes, that south dock is much airier. They've got native plants. They've got maples out there. It does feel sort of naturey, and you can see the lake much better. And even those patios where Billy Goat has a patio, where McDonald's even has a patio, where Riva does, that's actually a really beautiful place to eat. Some places that don't have patios include DMK Burger from, you probably know them from their other locations in Chicago, Freshie.
Yeah.
Tiny Tavern is going to open up. It's an extension of the Tiny Lounge from Ravenswood. Oh, wow.
Which is going to be the
craft cocktail bar.
Right.
I got to give some credit to the city of Chicago and the planners to be able to bring places like the Tiny Tavern in.
Yeah.
Right.
Because, you know, it could be an easy thing to just sort of punt to the establishment.
Right. Right.
And that's sort of what Mayor Daley did in 95, except for the ones that, you know, couldn't be McDonald's.
Right.
But that seems to be something that they're trying to modernize and at least stay ahead of the curve when it comes to a tourist, quote unquote, tourist trap.
Yeah, but I guess it's funny because Tiny Tavern, which is opening, one of the big things they're focusing on is they're saying they're going to be like an interior view. So they're kind of like highlighting the fact that they may not have the best view.
We have no view.
It's okay because we got great cocktails. But I got to say, I'm a big defender of some of the classic food that's at Navy Pier. And because you guys work there, like, I mean, 24/7 practically. And so for the people who are visiting, I think that now, especially with two classic places plus a new Navy Pier food place, it's actually pretty decent. So I'd say go get an appetizer, Garrett's, the Chicago mix, which is the caramel crisp corn with the cheese corn mixed together. You may be used to that for tourists. That's like actually a pretty novel,
original. It's a shorter line than the one downtown.
Yeah, and they're always giving free samples. A tip. And then also,
they're like, Louisa, go. We see you here
back
every
again.
Day.
Never a problem. And then also, they've got a nice Billy Goat there. And you can get their burgers. I would recommend that you kind of maybe, they always try to push you with the double. I say get single meat, double cheese. It's a better balance. But also, they've got those little beer cups where you can walk around the pier now with the beer. I mean, if it's in one of those official cups. Plus, also now, they do actually have an original rainbow cone. So,
oh, right.
It's a little bit more. We've talked about
this. $7.59 for just a cup of ice cream?
No, actually.
With a cone.
With a cone or a cup.
Ultimately, what will always be trouble for Chicagoans is that Navy Pier is not designed for Chicagoans.
Right.
The idea being that it's awesome to have a rainbow cone at Navy Pier because it's closer than the original rainbow cone on the south side.
Yeah.
But the idea being that you're going to pay tourist prices because that's essentially what's floating this tourist operation.
Yeah. If you're going now,
you'll pay $28 to park. You'll pay $8 for your rainbow cone.
Wait, $28 to park now?
Yeah. For mere mortals, but still about $2.95 for a single cheeseburger at Billy Goat. And I think if you get it on griddled rye bread and ask them to caramelize some onions, it's much tastier than those old nasty Kaiser rolls.
You ask the Billy Goat guys, are like, well, geez, double cheese.
Yeah.
Can you caramelize some onions? Can you drizzle that on, please?
With some
Evo, use a different
please?
Bread. I'm not sure they love you.
I have to say, I've done, again, they're much more accommodating on off-season
time.
Don't
do it on busy
time. Don't do it during the busiest time, seriously.
Well, tell me about the perch dinner.
What are your specials?
But a tip for parking is that for a lot of the restaurants, like Riva, you can get validated parking.
Can.
Yeah, it's like $12-$13 for like 3-4 hours. So way cheaper than $30 practically for parking.
Well, there you go.
Or if you're going to the Children's Museum, you can
Exactly. And the Children's Museum is fantastic. We know people work there. That still is a fantastic resource.
Louisa Chu, Monica Eng, my guests tonight. Chewing, the podcast, Bits, Bites, and Barbecue. The new episode drops on Friday. You can get it on iTunes, chicagotribune.com. When we come back, let's talk about Eddie Lakin's Facebook post. We'll just put it there. The idea of restaurants versus these third-party delivery services that are just exploding in this town and how there's a little bit of friction. We'll talk about that coming up here on The Download. Stay with us.
Did you hear the sound of the water?
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Louisa Chu, Monica Ang, Chewing the Podcast. New episode drops on Friday, Bits, Bites, and Barbecue. You can get the podcast at chicagotribune.com or iTunes. All right, let's wrap this up with a conversation that I think is going to change the world as we know it.
Mm-mm. Yes.
Third-party delivery services. You see it with Postmates, Grubhub, others that aren't at that level that are essentially offering the service to pick up delivery for you.
Right.
Now, what we're seeing sounds great on paper. Wow, technology is awesome, right? Mm-hmm. But what we're seeing is fees, hidden changes to the menu, and restaurants in particular, chefs, getting upset with the deal.
So our friend Eddie Lakin of Edzo's, you may know him better as Edzo's, had this conversation on Facebook with his friends that basically that these third-party delivery services, these food delivery people that he doesn't work with are basically delivering his food without his knowledge and permission, and then something happens, and then customers call, guess what, the restaurant to complain. So for example, you get one of the fine Edzo's burgers or fries, and there's a problem with it because maybe somebody who delivered it, which had nothing to do
with the
restaurant,
maybe it took an hour, who knows, it's cold or whatever. Yeah,
exactly. Contact the restaurant complaining. And so he had a real issue with that. And I think that, that is a serious issue. And some other people don't think there's a problem with that.
I don't believe they should hide the fact that they're a third party. But I think if there's transparency, hey, I can't make it over to Edzo's. I can't go to Shoko and get a sandwich. Or I don't have time to go to Chipotle and get some guacamole and fries. Why shouldn't Postmates bring it to me? And in fact, Postmates did. I did a story when Uber Eats started delivering Shoko sandwiches. And Postmates, I had them, I sort of went head to head. And this, I wanted some guacamole and chips. So this guy shows up on his bicycle. He tells me there's going to be a charge for it. I get my nice guacamole and chips. I go eat them upstairs. Same thing with the Uber Eats was a little more difficult. They couldn't find me. And then I kind of had to walk several blocks. But,
like the convenience of the way that technology is changing your world and the way that you're able to get food that you wouldn't normally be able to get delivered to you.
Yeah. If these restaurants aren't going to have a delivery service, why can't this third party?
Now, Eddie will say, and he said in the post that, a lot of his experience is about quality control. He doesn't offer delivery services because hamburgers in this case or fries or whatever it is change in their consistency, their chemistry, whatever it is.
Yeah.
By the time they go an hour to, they're not the same sort of Edzo's hamburger, and his reputation is on the line.
Absolutely.
But let the buyer beware and let them be very aware of what this is and what this isn't. This isn't Edzo's saying this is going to taste like an Edzo's burger at the restaurant. This is a third party guy saying, you know what, you can't get off your but to get this, I'll get it for you.
And that's exactly the problem, is that there is not transparency. And as you noted, Justin, that sometimes these prices on the menus are changed.
That's where I fall in the camp with Louisa, where they're essentially saying that a burger that was $5 is now $7 because they're trying to up. So you're just looking at the site to see what the Edzo's. And a lot of times, which I found interesting on the comment thread, a lot of times these sites that have no affiliation and no sort of handshake deal even with the restaurant, they're skimming and grabbing their graphics and making menu pages to look like it's a restaurant, changing the prices.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that restaurants go to they go a long way to make sure that they want to serve the food at the prices and the temperature, everything about it, the way they want to. And these companies kind of change that.
Completely. And as someone who grew up in the restaurant business here in Chicago, delivering food. What?
When you were 8 years old.
Exactly. Yeah. My first job was 4 years old at the deep fryer. Yeah. And I started delivering. I think I started delivering when I was like 8 or 9 years old. You know, I mean, delivering chop suey to your house. So this is not a new thing. It was a big deal in terms of like how you packed it and then how long it took to get there. And so it's not transparent. And then when you do delivery, the price is the same price as the menu. And then clearly the delivery charge is clearly posted. You don't change your delivery menu prices when it's your own restaurant. So why, if that's not clear, again,
I think
those teachers
dress
as pies, it's a big red flag.
But I think the big question is, let's say the restaurant says, no, I don't want you to deliver my stuff. Should they be able to stop a guy from standing in line and getting three cheeseburgers and walking out the door and saying, hey, I'll give you my cheeseburger if you pay me 50
and
cents.
And scalping more. Their cheeseburgers? Yes, I think
really?
That they should
stop them.
Really?
You want to control
them.
These people on
yes,
the sidewalk who just want 50%?
I do.
50%?
Yes,
oh,
I think
on.
That that is
yeah,
something.
Because you want to control everything, Louisa.
No, I don't. I think that actually this falls under rules and regulations. You know, we've had
know
so
if
many
it does.
Issues. Well, I guess if you were in this business, Monica, you might know. But as someone who actually has had a food handler license, and again, this is one of the big deals that happened with, for example, food trucks coming into Chicago. Oh, there's this big hubbub in terms of like transporting food. It had to be prepackaged at a central kitchen, had to be dated, et cetera, et cetera. Why is it okay to just scalp your burger on the sidewalk? I mean, you know, it's a whole other issue when you're doing it for profit. I am not saying that there is an issue. We've talked about this previously with like Good Samaritan laws, like donating food. But this is a for-profit business. And
they're going to go in there and buy three cheeseburgers just so I can donate them.
If you want to give them away. But that's a whole other issue. That's
all
a whole
right.
Other
we'll
issue.
Continue the I like this conversation, and I think we should continue it another time. The podcast Chewing is out. Bits, Bites, and Barbecue just in time for Father's Day is out this Friday. You can find the podcast at Chicago Tribune as well as on iTunes. Monica Ang and Louisa Chu. Always a pleasure to have you guys here, and I can't wait for you to return.
Thank you, Justin.
Thanks, Justin.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my next guest can be seen in the new Mike Birbiglia film, Don't Think Twice. He also stars in his own TV talk show, The Chris Gethard Show, on Fusion. He's told stories on This American Life, and he can be seen on the hit show Broad City on Comedy Central. And he's got a podcast on Earwolf called Beautiful/Anonymous. Chris Gethard is hilarious in several different mediums. He's on stage at Talia Hall tomorrow night performing his solo show Career Suicide as part of the AV Club Festival, and he joins me now. Chris, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Oh, I'm very flattered to be a part of things.
How often do you find yourself getting through Chicago?
I get through Chicago once every few years. I performed probably a year and a half, 2 years ago at the Up Comedy Club when they were still doing stand-up stuff. That was very fun. And I was like an improv nerd coming up. I started out at the Upright Citizens Brigade. So I used to actually, like when I was in college, I would drive out to Chicago on my winter breaks to just go watch improv. So I have like I put Chicago on a pedestal comedically, and it's always like really rad when I get to come through and be a part of things.
Well, let's talk about UCB because that's been a big part of your comedy pedigree. Obviously, having success with the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York is a really great thing for a comedy career. Talk about how you got involved with UCB and what you've taken with it since, you know, you've moved on in your career.
Well, I got lucky. Like, I started there. I think it was right before my 20th birthday. I just signed up and took a class. I didn't really know anything about it. I was just, like, a depressed kid at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And I, like, was doing a little bit of comedy down there and really loved it. And just showed up at UCB when I was, like, super young, and it was still a really small place. And I was kind of, like, too young to know how intimidated I should have been. Like,
right.
Just like kind of a dummy. Like I was 21 years old and I was on an improv team with Jack McBrayer and Rob Corddry, which like I should have just been terrified all the time. I should have been completely scared, but I was just too young and dumb and having too much fun. So just got in there early, managed to hang around. People thought I was like funny and hardworking, and that went a long way. And just like, you know, it's like kind of blown up in the like, since then. And it's much bigger than it used to be, but I feel like it's just like an environment where I was around the best people, around these really hardworking people, and it just made me realize, like, I better work hard. Like, I've never been the funniest guy in the room, but because of that, I always try to be the hardest working guy in the room, and I always just try to be the most honest person, the most, like, whatever I can put up on stage that feels honest and raw and, like, it has integrity.
Yeah,
that's always what I go for, and I think it's just, that's a lot of that is because at UCB, it was like you kind of just had to... You had to keep it real. You had to come correct or else you're going to get swallowed up because there's just too many people around.
Well, you talk a lot about honesty. I mean, the one-person show that you're putting on Career Suicide, you're telling stories and doing stand-up, but the show takes on issues like mental illness, depression, suicide, you know, all the staples of a comedy show. Why explore those issues on stage? How, I mean, as a comic, is it easy for you to open up in that way and talk about your own issues? How difficult is it to engage with an audience with those topics?
Actually, like, incredibly hard. And to me, that's, like, sort of the value in doing it is, like, I feel like when I was at UCB, like, I got, you know, I was getting a lot of like, respect as an improviser. And I'm like, I could have kept doing that, but I'd rather do something that feels scary and hard again. So it became stand-up where being on stage by myself felt so scary. And then it was like, you know, that I was starting to figure out. So it's like now... let's make the stories just more revealing, a little more honest, a little more terrifying to put out there. Because I just feel like as an artist, it's how you got to do it. And it, even then, like, it wasn't necessarily something I was looking to do. I actually, like, toured with Mike Birbiglia for a long time. I used to open for him on the road. And, you know, we're on the road on these long drives in the middle of the night. You wind up just, like, telling each other everything. So told him a lot of stories about my past and, like, things that I'd been through that were really dark that dealt with some of this stuff, like depression and stuff. And he, I'd tell him these stories, and he'd be like, dude, you got to tell that on stage. That's hilarious. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, Mike, that's a story about me trying to kill myself. And he's like, I'm telling you, I don't want to be mean. That story's hilarious. Tell it on stage. And it just seemed like the most ill-advised thing to do. And that kind of, in my gut, is like, well, I should try that then if that seems like a really bad idea. So luckily, Mike found these, like, very tales I thought for him he thought might have some comedic potential.
Well, I mean, watching the Chris Gethard show on Public Access on the Manhattan Neighborhood Network before it made the move to Fusion, and even before that on stage, there seems to be elements of being very honest, being very open. It's a very creative show. I mean, I was just watching some of the stuff, you know, like not sleeping for 36 hours or, you know, taking on different elements that aren't necessarily a part of a TV talk show. How much does the honesty and getting up on stage and being yourself and being real play into the projects that you're doing, especially the Chris Gethard show?
Well, it's at the core of everything, just this feeling of honesty, wanting to be myself, wanting to connect with real people out there. And a lot of that is just born out of necessity. Like, you know, I'm very, very grateful that I came up at UCB, but it also meant I was in an environment where everyone around me started getting incredibly successful. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't. I was just this guy who was kind of still in the trenches, gutting it out, doing shows. And it caused a lot of stress. And what I found was, like, the more open I was about that and the more open I was about, like, look, I'm just this guy who's trying to make stuff, the more people just genuinely clicked with it and appreciated it. And what I found is, like, especially with the Chris Gethard show, like, we were on Public Access TV a year after I was a star of a sitcom that just bombed hard. And I would talk about it. I'd be like, I feel like such a loser. Like, I almost had a sitcom, and now I have a Public Access show. But people would call in consistently and be like, oh, that's awesome. I feel like a loser, too. And we would just kind of commiserate and be like, oh, well, this is like the island of misfit toys.
Yeah.
It actually, like, really inspiring to me. It made me stop chasing, like, the ego-driven definition of success and realize, like, oh, if I can actually connect with people and be honest, make people laugh if they're having a hard day, like, that's what it's all about. That's what it's really about. So
I think of the different things that you've done across platforms, you've really had to adjust your comedy to different audiences. First, you started with the Chris Gethard show on stage at UCB. So that's a closed 40, 50 people, 80, 100 people, whatever it is. They come out to see you perform in a comedy shop. When you're actually making the move to Public Access and you're on the Manhattan Neighborhood Network, there's a different audience that might be watching that at home. It's not necessarily as easy to relate with the audience as it was before.
It's totally true. And it was crazy. It's like, you know, you do it at UCB where I'd been at, when we started the show, I think I'd been at the theater for 11 years. It's like very much like that's like a safe space. And then we went on Manhattan Public Access and all of a sudden, like, we'd get phone calls from people, and it was just people who lived in Manhattan just like brutally prank calling us, or people just like, we pick up the phone and like be like, hey, what do you want to talk about? And they'd be like, this show isn't funny. That's what I want to talk about. And I'm like, oh, this is crazy. This is rough and really brutal. But then, you know, some people started calling in and saying they did like it. And then it became cool because, you know, it streams online. And then it was like, oh, my God, we got a call from New Jersey. Yeah. Oh, we got a call from Pennsylvania. And then we started getting calls from Sweden and Brazil. And it was just like, oh, there's like sad sack nerds all over the globe finding this thing, clicking with it. And it just became this like really exhilarating thing that really kind of saved my whole career, I think, was the fact that all these kids started reaching out. So it was an uphill battle for sure. But we got someplace pretty cool, and I'm pretty proud of it.
Yeah, it's a great show, and, you know, it's in its second season on Fusion. Talk about the challenge of taking something that really, really grew on Public Access and transferring that to a cable network. I mean, it's a different kind of thing than Public Access. But talk about the challenge of adapting your material to the next level.
Well, I mean, the big challenge, obviously, is, like, Public Access. There are straight-up no rules. Like, the show that followed us, most weeks was straight up just naked ladies dancing while a guy grinned into the camera and waved money around. Like, there's no rules.
Yeah,
there's
classic New York public access, right?
Oh, it's like the Wild West. It's completely insane. And, like, you know, you go up there and it's like, well, if we have a bad episode or even two or three bad episodes in a row, like, it doesn't matter. No one cares. It gives us a lot of room to experiment creatively. Whereas you jump to cable and all of a sudden it's like, well, now you got to put up or shut up. Like, people are putting some money behind this thing. There's some expectations. There's a network that has mandates and they want to have a say and you can't just do whatever you want. And it sounds like, you know, I don't want it to come off like, oh, these like development people brought down the iron fist. It was more like, oh, like, you know, like you guys need to have discipline, basically. You need to have a sense of discipline and awareness about how you only get 10 chances at this now, and each chance has some money put behind it, and we better think pretty hard about this and really try to do it right. So there's this thing of like, we gotta try to take everything we learn through all the experimentation and all the failure and like really, you know, really recognize the fact that our audience loves that risk-taking, loves the fact that we'll fail publicly, but also do our best to retain what's cool about that right, while still right. minimizing the fact that we might fall on our face and just waste tens of thousands of dollars.
But what I really like about it, Chris, is that it's authentic. It came from the stage. It went to public access. It went to Fusion. It's not something that, you know, a bunch of writers got in a room and said, what if we had people sitting on the floor? What if there was a bit? Like, everything about what it is on Fusion, you can see the organic path or journey that you took to get it to this point. And there has to be something easy about that. Does that make sense?
Well, it's easy in the sense of like, you know, it's like because it's just like the show that refuses to die at the end of the day. Like, I'm more surprised than anyone that this is still a thing that exists, let alone that it's actually worked out and been my job. But I think the easy part of it is like all the people who got on board with it from the earliest days, I always had this feeling of like, we're doing something special and I'm not going to quit on it. Like, I wouldn't go out like, you know, my agents wanted me to go to pilot season and they would get mad I was doing public access and I fired my agents. Like, that's not a smart move career-wise, but it was like, I don't want to go chase the traditional things. I really feel like there's something special happening here. And it meant that the people who got on board with it and stayed on board with it, it's like a family. It really is. Like, we're this tribe of goons, basically, mm-hmm. who all spent a couple of years going like, well, we're losing money on this thing. At times, it's really hard to pull off. At times, it can be a little embarrassing at how bad it can be. But when it's good, there's really something worth hanging on to. And that gives us this like foundation of strength that I don't think any other show really has, because we've proven what we need to prove. And like at the end of the day, like if our show gets canceled or if they don't like our ideas, it doesn't like it's all these people are still going to be my best friends. All these people are at like family level to me. And that's just the thing that can't get taken away. And that's like so rare, you know, like
yeah.
when we shot our pilot, I remember one of the network people was like, man, people work for years to try to get a show that has chemistry like this behind the scenes. And you guys nailed it on your first episode. And it's like, no, our first episode here. We spent years
right.
doing this on the road, doing this at UCB, doing this on public access when no one was watching. It's just a family. It's a family behind the scenes, and that's just such a source of strength.
Well, it's one of the best TV talk shows out there, The Chris Gethard Show. It's the second season on Fusion. You can see Chris tomorrow night. He's going to be at Talia Hall as part of the AV Club Festival, the second annual AV Club Festival. He's going to be doing his one-man show, Career Suicide. You can also see Chris in the new Mike Birbiglia film. You can hear him on the Earwolf podcast, Beautiful/Anonymous, This American Life, Every Which Way, Broad City. Chris Gethard, I can't thank you enough for taking some time out to talk to us tonight.
No, please. It's my pleasure, and I hope I get to meet some of the listeners out at Talia Hall tomorrow.
I kind of want to just keep playing this. This is good. There we go. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for Picnic. We usually do this on Tuesdays, but the new summer lineup has us doing it on Wednesdays. 312-981-7200. Tonight, we give another nickname, a legitimate, authentic crowdsource nickname to a member of the 2016 Chicago Cubs. We've got it so far. We've had a great run. Dexter Fowler, he is free range. Then we went to Kyle Hendricks. He was the calculator. We went to Justin Grimm. He's the Grim Reaper. It's time for the harvest. I think that was the add to that. We also had Javi Baez, who is Babyface. Who am I missing? The two we did last week, which were my favorite, Pedro Strop, which was White Castle because he's got the best slider in the business. And then Addison Russell, Smooth Criminal. You've been struck by a smooth criminal.
Also have Tommy La Stella.
Tommy La Stella, Tommy Gunn.
Mm-hmm. And Hector Rondon.
Which was Hectoro.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's good, guys. This is good. Esmeralda Leon, she makes the call. She's the judge. She's the judge, the jury, and the executioner.
There's some good choices, though. So I have something good to work with.
Okay. So you need good choices.
Yeah.
Martier is our statistician, our research fellow, who will come up with a really thoughtful nickname.
Well, Pete has laid down a challenge to me tonight.
Okay.
Off the air, Justin, just so you know, sometimes Pete and I talk a little bit. He's down there on the main floor with you in the Allstate Showcase studio. I'm up here on 7. And I said, you know, Big Z, I blurted it out when you were talking about the segment.
Good start.
And Pete said, yeah, that's good, Rob, but I've got one tonight.
Ooh.
And I went, oh, really? Ooh. Now do you?
All right.
Okay. Let's and he's back it. On the sugar, too. So.
All right. All right. So 312-981-7200. Text or call in your suggestion for the nickname for second baseman Ben Zobrist. Ben Zobrist, a lot of opportunities with the Z. We already got the Big Z, the Zobe, the wrist. There's something in there. Pete Zimmerman, what do we know before we get your idea? What do we know about Ben Zobrist?
Ben Zobrist is an Illinois native.
Okay.
He grew up in the area. It was Eureka, home of Ronald Reagan, or yeah. Ronald Reagan went to school. He's married to a country singer. Who's who just on Sunday sang the national anthem? Okay. He is an outstanding guy for on base percentage.
He gets on base.
He gets on base a lot, and he's having a great year. He's hitting like almost 400 since the middle of April.
Okay.
He rarely strikes out, although he struck out like four times in a row just recently, but he's a
contact hitter.
Yeah. And a super utility player. Right field are probably his two best positions. Also can play shortstop. They can pretty much find a position for him anywhere.
Okay.
Lives in Nashville.
Mm.
He's a Christian.
Mm.
And he has three kids, I believe, and they have weird names. Like one of them has... like the middle name is Royal for the Kansas City Royals. He was on the World Series champion.
He's also got a pedigree of playing on playoff teams. He played in Tampa Bay for a couple of years when they were good.
Yep.
He won the World Series last year with Kansas City.
Yep.
Before that, did we determine he was in Oakland?
He played for Oakland. He signed with Oakland prior to last season, and then he played half the season, then got traded to the Royals.
Right. So, okay. All right. Why don't we do this? Why don't I pick whatever? I already see some stuff coming in. So why don't we do this? 773. I think it was 773. I'm trying to find it. It's deep in here. Don't mess with the Zobhan. like Zohan. Was that the Adam Sandler movie? Don't mess with the Zohan.
It's too long.
Zohan. So maybe I'm saying Zobhan. No, that's no good. All right, no one's out. You're out.
That was a terrible movie.
Why would you?
We need to keep bringing it up every time we say his name.
214. I like this one. This is going to rival you, Rob. Ready? Z Biscuit. Because Zobrist had no offers when he first graduated high school, he thought of quitting. The Triple Crown champion racehorse Z Biscuit was the butt of stable jokes when he started out as a 2-year-old, but then became a huge star.
So the other horses were making fun of Z Biscuit? Is that it? I mean, do they do that?
They do.
All
they
right.
Neigh in a certain way.
Z Biscuit. All right, it's weak, but we'll let it stretch its legs.
312 says Zorilla. It's not bad. Zorilla. You like the big Z up there. I got a ton here. I have a ton.
Yeah, that was my visceral first response, you know, the big Z. It's simple.
All right, ready for these?
Fire
these
away.
Are coming away in from Matt Klein, who's a regular here in the Cubs Fan Jam. Tommy, Coley, all these people are sending texts in. The big Ute, because he's a utility player. Zeus, for the Z, that's not bad. Zobrist, Zeus. Zorbo the Great. I don't even know what that. Flex, because he plays so many different positions.
Yeah.
Bionic. Bionic Ben Zobrist represents his age and his slash line. Or simply slash, because he's got good stats. Benzo, this is good. Like Mercedes-Benz. Isn't Ben Zobrist?
Yeah, but then, you know, that's doing the hockey thing again. Taser, yeah. Caner.
Yeah, right, right. All right, let's go to some of these. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Andrew. Andrew, what do you like for picnic for Ben Zobrist?
Hey, Zobased.
Zobased. All right. Well, why?
Why not, man? You know, he's always on base. It kind of rhymes. Give it a little, give it a little zing.
There you go. All right. All right, Andrew. Thank you for that. Thank you for Zobase. We'll put that on there. All right. As 312 calls out, Big Z was Carlos Zambrano. That was his nickname, so you can't really go there. 847 says, how about Zenbo? 708 says, Bezo. 630 says, Planet Z. Or how about 262 who says, Cool Hand Zook? There's a lot. I don't know, man. Zoberkill. Okay. All right. Let's go to Molly. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Justin.
Okay. So, what do we got for Ben Zobrist?
Ben Zobrist is the carpenter.
Okay,
because for two reasons. One is that his wife is a Christian pop star, so we have the Jesus angle.
Okay.
And then he plays a lot of positions, so he has a lot of tools in his toolbox.
He's a five-tool player, right?
Right.
Oh, man, I like that one. Molly, coming through. Thank you, Molly.
But I kind of like Cool Hand Zook, too, though.
I just love, I don't even think Zook is a word, right? So just be, and it's not Zobrist, so Cool Hand Zook. All right, well, we'll try it. Thanks, Molly. How about 319 says World War Z? Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Carl. Carl, what do you like for Ben Zobrist?
Yes, yeah. Cool Hand Zook. You got to be kidding me. How about Obi-Wan Kenobi?
That's good.
Yeah.
Obi-Wan Kenobi playing up to Star Wars. But what does that have to do with Ben Zobrist? Oh, I guess Ben, right.
Well,
Ben Kenobi, right.
Zobrist? Zobi? No?
Yeah, okay.
Right. I know it's a stretch, guys.
We'll try. Okay. Thanks, Carl. Okay. Thanks for calling.
Yep.
he's already out. He's like, I know it's a stretch. I'm sorry I even played. They call him a super utility player, and he's a millennial, so let's call him Sup, as in what's up. Yeah. All right, 312-981-7200. Keep him coming. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Ben Zobrist, he's the target for tonight's picnic. Stay with us. Is this Ben Zobrist's wife?
It is.
Huh.
He uses this for his walk-up.
Does he really? He does not.
He does.
Well, Frank Thomas used to do that with, he started the practice, and this is a lore. He's credited with the guy who did the walk-up music. And the reason is because, remember, he had his own record label. So he saw it as a way for him to promote the people who were on his record label.
Oh, yeah.
That's how it started. And then I believe he did, he then turned to, I love it when you call me Big Papa, put your hands in the air. That was his big song he did for 10 years or whatever.
Nice. We'll be talking to Big Hurt soon.
Yeah, I can't wait, man. I love that guy. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Frank. Frank, what do we like for Ben Zobrist on Picnic?
Hi.
Hi.
I got two.
Okay.
Mr. Versatile.
Okay.
Because he gets around, he does a lot of different things. And or Zooty.
Zooty.
Yeah, there was a guy back years ago, and a band leader. He was a player. His name was, they called him Zoot Sims. That was his name.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Also, I pick Zooty or Mr. Versatile.
I love it. Thanks, Frank. Thanks for calling in. We'll see if those hold up. Mr. Versatile or Zooty. All right. 312 says, what about Zombie? I don't know if that really plays. There's a lot of Z's that are not that close, but we're getting closer. Zoe Money. That works. How about Brisket? Playing his name and the fact that he can play many positions. Kit. So Brisket. Although I'm not sure what the Bris, Ben Zobrist. Oh, is it? Got it. 708 says Zoot Suit. Zoe Money was Carmen. That's okay. Ben Zorbo the Great. All right, 312 says Zippy. 309 says Z400 for his batting average. Okay. 708 says Zobriety Check. These are getting ridiculous. 630 says, how about the belt? He's a utility player. The belt. Okay. 847 says Z Champ. That's good. Okay, let's go to the phones. They're coming in fast and furious. Ruth, what do you like, Ruth?
Hello?
Hi. What do you like? What do you like? Do you like for a picnic? Ben Zobrist.
I like Zuber or Zephyr.
Zuber or Zephyr?
Yeah, I like Zephyr a lot. Like a speeding train.
Okay. Okay. All right. I like that. That's a good Z. Thanks, Ruth. Okay. Rich, what do you like, Rich, for Ben Zobrist?
Yeah, hey, the British pronounce Z as a Z, so you could have the big Z.
The big Z. All right, I like that too. Thanks, Rich. Okay, we're getting somewhere. Let's go to Sharon. Sharon, what do we like for Ben Zobrist?
Zooby Doo. Because he does.
Zooby Zooby Doo. I like it. I like that a lot. Thank you, Sharon. Rick, what do we got? Rick, what do you like?
My suggestion is the Zamboni.
The Zamboni. And that's the wrong sport. So you say he freshens up the ice? What's your tagline?
He cleans everything up well.
Oh, he cleans everything up. Okay, that's good. I liked it a lot. All right, Rick, thank you for that. All right, Pete Zimmerman. Rob kind of sort of said you got something. What are you thinking?
My guess was stolen.
By who?
Oh, no.
The Carpenter.
Oh, the Carpenter.
Oh.
I do like that one. That is high on the list here.
And what's the Carpenter connection?
Jesus was a carpenter. Ben Zobrist is a Christian.
Oh.
Plays up his Christian things. And then he's, a utility guy, wears a lot of belts, has a lot of tools in his pocket, things of that nature.
Yeah.
Well, Pete challenged me tonight. I do like the Carpenter, I will admit. But you know me. I always like to try to find some sort of connection to the player's past.
All right, I like this.
You heard Pete mention that he's from Eureka, Illinois, home of Eureka College. Now, Eureka's mascot is the Red Devils. So, Ben, the Red Devil Zobrist.
The Red Devil. I like that.
The Red Devil.
The Red Devil. Esmeralda.
I do like that one. That's really far, though, to connect, but I like it.
The Red Devil. If he kind of, does he have red hair? He's a blonde. So close. Just dye it for us. You can dye that. Then it all comes together, right? Maybe we can work with his people, get him a new look. Get him a Rick Sutcliffe kind of look. Go with the red devil. There is a history here. The Red Baron. Now he's the Red Devil. Could work. All right, we'll continue after the news. Ben Zobrist is our choice tonight for Picnic. Want to give him an authentic, legitimate crowdsource nickname. Keep him coming. 312-981-7200. Esmeralda will pick after the news. And whoever wins gets pizza. Stay with us. She sounds good. It's so good. I mean, if you're going to be one of the best baseball teams, you have to have pop star, you know, spouses, right? You can't have just regular spouses. You have to have pop star spouses. It's just how it is. Take a look at, like, the Yankees or the Dodgers, like the Golden State, the Miami Heat, you know? Dwayne Wade, he's out there with his Gabriel Union yelling at the refs, you know? All right, 312-981-7200. Ben Zobrist. We're trying to pick a nickname for Mr. Zobrist. We got such great stuff, and I've narrowed it down. Here's one coming in late that I think has actually been brought up by a couple of people now, and I think it might be one that is a contender. This one from 219, Zorro. Zorro the Swinging Swordsman. I kind of like that. Zorro, I can see a Ben Zobrist. I mean, obviously tonight everyone's going with the Zorro. And then you could do a lot with that, you know, because you've got the mask and the hat and the cool signs you can make that are like, Zorro, you know, that kind of thing. And doesn't Zorro save, like, he saves lives? Does Zorro save lives? No? He's a bandit of some sort. Steals bases. He defends the village. He play different positions. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not sure on Zorro. All right, I want to keep reading here as we wrap it up here. 815 says Zoke. 214 is really pushing Brisket because he's a premium cut. If Michael Jackson can name his son Blanket, we can name Ben Brisket. So there's that. You know what? Just for that, I'm going to put Brisket in the finals. That's great. Zorilla came back, 262, going back with Zorilla. The Tool Man, 262, likes Tool Man, 5 Tool. Another Zorro. How about, hey, Zooby-Doo? That's what it says here, and that's pretty funny.
I think Zorilla needs to be disqualified, because I think that's an official, like, Joe Madden has called him Zorilla.
Oh, that's out. So, yeah. You can't
tell. This is a new...
This is legitimate... authentic crowdsource nickname. You can't steal it from the real nicknames. Mm-hmm. Right. All right. I feel good. I feel like I'm going through them right now. Benjamin here. Matt Klein sent a ton here. They're pretty funny. All right. Here we go. The Big Utility, Shake Weight. I don't know why shake weight. Zobra, like a cobra.
That's pretty good.
Zobra. He strikes. Watch out, don't get too close to the Zobra, or you'll be looking for a vaccine. Or no, they don't call them vaccine, the antidote, right? Sorry. He'll bite you. Hey, that is good, you know, the game's on the line. You don't want to get a rise out of the Zobra. I like that one. Zozo Beware, kind of a Coco Beware from wrestling. Benjamin Franklin. Zobias. Biblical. That's not bad. You know, there's a lot of Christian stuff.
Yeah,
Zobias.
I like that.
The Walking Zed. He also went with a Zobie Wan. All right.
Those are some good
ones. Those are good. Tommy and Coley have got Blue Collar Ben. BZ. C-Dub for Country Western.
Ah.
Country Western. Bezo, class act, because he's a class act. And I didn't know this. They also told me that he has a fan club at the park, and they're called the Zobros. Of course they are. All right, so I think we got enough, Pete. Here's what, let me just check real quick, see if we got any new ones. Zozo, the Zeppelin reference. Okay. Godzilla, because he tears down all the cities he goes to. And he said, and 773 said, you can't do Zorro. It's already taken. But, like, is there a Zorro on the team?
On the Cubs? No.
No.
I don't think so.
No. Hectoro, which that's different. All right. So, this is what I got, Pete. The Carpenter, the Red Devil, Zorro, the Zamboni, benzo, like the Mercedes-Benz, brisket, and zobra. I don't know. Could I throw one in? Mine would be, I'd call him Batman. Because Batman's got the utility belt.
Zobrist
is a utility player. He always finds a way to get out of the jam because he's got his cool utility belt. Zobrist always getting us out of jams with big hits, clutch hits. He's kind of looks like Christian Bale a little bit. No, not even close. All right, I'm done. That was just a throw-in at the end just for entertainment value. All right, so out of those seven, Carpenter, Red Devil, Zorro the Zamboni, Benzo, Brisket, or Zobra, what do we like? 773, just now people are, I like this. People are like, Benzo. They like Benzo. Yeah. Benzobris, Benzo, Benz, Mercedes-Benz. That's a cool car. It's a fast car, so smooth.
What was the brisket? I like saying brisket.
Brisket because it's Zobrist, brisket, and that's a real good cut of meat. And he's a good cut. He's got a good cut. Mm. Mm. All right, should we get rid of brisket?
Well, this is not for me to decide, but...
If I were going to cut these down, I mean, there's seven of them. I think you got to get rid of brisket, and I think you got to get rid of, and I hate to do this to Rob, but the Red Devil. I don't think that's going to stick. That's hard. I mean, that's so a hard mad. One. I know, he gets so mad. He gets like Steve Gadlin mad. All right, so the Carpenter, Zorro, the Zamboni, Benzo, and Zobra. Ooh. Esmeralda Leon, how you doing?
Good.
All right, you've been listening. This is a tough one. There's not a runaway. I feel like everyone really got caught up in the Z. Like everyone was like, you know what? It's got to be Zo. Z. So, I'm going to read them to you, and you're going to choose. The Carpenter, Zorro, the Zamboni, Benzo, or Zobra?
No, Zobra is because Cobra?
Yeah.
Okay.
You don't want to mess with the Zobra.
I'm liking Zorro or Benzo.
Okay. All right, so let's get rid of the other ones here.
So Zorro, I like because it means something.
Yeah, right.
Benzo is just because
that's his name.
Benzo.
And I guess that's like a nickname for a fast car.
Okay.
Although 630 says Benzo like the torch, Benzomatic, whatever that means.
Okay.
But I was thinking like Mercedes Benz, but like if I was a Wrigleyville bro, I'd be like, hey man, cool Benzo.
Oh.
Right? Hmm. Oh my God, you got such a cool Benzo. That's an awesome Benzo. That's an amazing Benzo.
I think I'm going to go with Zorro.
Zorro. I would go with Zorro too. I think that's a winner. We got a winner.
Really?
Zorro.
He could wear an outfit if he wanted to.
Right. And that gives us a lot of opportunities for signs and for masks. Yeah. And we can wear the little mask to the game.
I'm thinking a Halloween because, you know, they have to dress up. He dresses
and
up
it's
like
October.
Zorro.
Right. Think about like there's going to be a Halloween game in the World Series. And everyone dressing up like Zorro, and he comes up. There's some huge play that you can get on national TV that way.
And when he wins, he pulls out a sword and he does a Z on everyone's shirts.
Right. Yeah. He does it in the dirt by home plate.
Oh, there you go.
Like when he sets up with his bat. Oh, he does it with his bat. And then he carries his bat around, and he hits the players when he goes around the bases.
No, maybe
I took it too far.
I don't think they can do that.
That's good.
I don't know much about baseball, but I don't think they can do that.
All right. I like it. Zorro it is. Ben Zobrist is now from this point forward, Zorro. And we want to thank
him up, tell him.
We should, right? Well, there's got to be a way at the end of this segment that we get all the players to say their names. We'll figure it out. Okay, so there were a lot of Zorros. There were probably like three, so I guess we'll just try to give away as many pizzas as we can. No? You don't like it? Just a little too hanging.
Oh, we'll pick the first person. We'll take the
first person.
Person.
There we go. Get some pizza. Just a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. Give it up for Ben Zobrist. He is now officially Zorro. It's just a character flaw. Oh, it's time for Character Flaws here on WGN The Download. I'm Justin Kaufman. We expected to do a little bit more Character Flaws, but we went over in giving Ben Zobrist a great new nickname, so we're going to do a truncated Character Flaws here. You know, it is June. Today's June 1st, so it is Pride Month, so we thought, why not start there? Well, I'm very excited here on Character Flaws because it's June 1st, and you know what June means in Chicago. It is Pride Month, Gay Pride Month, which culminates with the Gay Pride Parade at the end of the month. We thought this month here at Character Flaws we would bring you up to speed on some of the issues and things that are happening in the gay community with our Download's Gay Pride Month correspondent, Jim Bennett. Jim, welcome to the show.
Oh, my gosh. Happy to be here.
This is great. You know, I think that maybe you can help us shed some light on some of the issues and raise awareness of some of the things that the gay community are dealing with in Chicago. First, June 1st, you got to be excited.
Yeah, I'm sort of over it, Justin.
It just started. What do you mean?
Well, we're in the educational phase. So, like, June 1st is going to begin, like, all educational events where you're going to have to learn about things without the open bars or parties. And that sort of comes in a little bit later towards the end of the month. So, you know, it's about learning.
That's still, I mean, that's good. I mean, awareness and learning. I mean, you're probably picking up some things you didn't know about your community or about being gay.
Oh, yeah, totally. All the corporations are having their Pride Month. So we go into those companies and we tell our coming out story. So that's really huge because everyone has a gay kid now. So it's like they all know these stories. Mm. And so they then tell you theirs, and they're all very nice. But the important thing is just to really have something good, something that's going to get people to cry. And then, but you want a redeeming moment at the end of the story, like that you want people to get back together and stuff like that.
So you really kind of want to jazz it up.
Well, you've got to jazz it up because a lot of times now these parents, especially like these Linkin Park parents, they want a gay kid. Like, I mean, it's all the rage. So you want to have something that's a little more, you know, like some kind of church where they didn't accept you. But now even like Presbyterians, Lutherans, Episcopalians, they're all fine with the gays.
It's hard. Yeah, it's harder for that.
So you still got a bunch of
Methodists. You almost have to, Methodists or Scientologists,
right?
Yeah,
they're still sort of off the edge. But, you know, they're the caboose of the civil rights movement. But the rest of them, pretty good.
All right, so you got to have a good coming out story.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the issues at play here. I mean, obviously last year, gay marriage was a big thing. That was right before Pride. Are we going to see a lot of that coming up here in June? Are we still excited about marriage?
Well, you know, I mean, the question's been called now. I mean, you know, you can't just have a relationship and be legal strangers and get away with an affair. So, we're very excited about it. There's going to be a lot of June weddings. So what I would say, especially from the GLBT perspective, is the importance of registering for gifts, because everyone now, Macy's, Crate and Barrel, all the key places are going to have registrations for women or men or men and women if they're still doing it. And you've just got to get your gifts. You know, I mean, it's self-loathing if you're not registered for gifts.
Okay, well, that's just probably less about pride and more just marriage etiquette.
Well, it's just good marriage advice.
Yeah.
It's good marriage advice. But, you know, we're everywhere now, so everyone needs to be ready for this.
Another issue that is playing out in the trans community is bathrooms. You've obviously got an opinion on that. I know you. You've got an opinion on that.
I do. Well, first of all, I just say when you have to go to the bathroom, you go to the bathroom. Like, you go where you feel like you need to be. It's not healthy to hold it. But I would say, for me, I look for really nice restaurants. And I act like I'm getting my seat, so I act like I'm meeting someone. And then I go back into the restroom, because the fancy restaurants have those own private little rooms, like where the walls go all the way up to the ceiling, down to the floor. And I just like to be able to take a moment for me, just recapture my thoughts and think about things and how I'm going to go out in the day and who I'm going to meet. And then I go out, and then you just act like you forgot or you messed up your plans, and then you can leave. Usually you can get in.
I don't think that's the issue with bathrooms, is where you go to the bathroom. It's who can go in what bathroom, right?
Well, that's the issue for others, you know. But for the community, the LGBT community, we're fine where you just go where you feel like you should be. So if you feel like you should be in the women's bathroom, you should probably be in the women's bathroom. Mm. But again, like I would say, check the stall. Make sure that there's no urine or anything on the seat, because there's nothing worse than that. if you're a guy, I always lift up the seat with my foot so that I'm not getting any germs.
Okay.
And if they have that toilet paper thing that zooms that toilet paper around, I always say use that.
Again, that just doesn't seem like it's necessarily advice for Pride Month. That's just bathroom advice.
Well, you should wash your hands. You should always, after you go, you should wash your hands. Or at least the hand that you've used.
So this is the... you know, the first day of Pride Month, what can we expect coming up here? I mean, when do the parties start?
Wow. Well, you'll see a lot of rainbows. We're still using that. The more sophisticated cities like Chicago will just use blues and purples, but we won't use the entire rainbow except for on actual Pride Parade. I think you'll see a lot of events in corporations. If you're gay at a corporation, this is when you're going to collect. This is when you're going to get the things. You're going to get a lot of giveaways, and people are going to have to be especially nice to you. It's reasonable to ask your boss to take you to lunch or drinks afterwards if you want. But really what you should be looking for in a Pride event is first an open bar, an alcohol sponsor. You should make sure that it's not just beer. I mean, you know, the lesbians drink beer, and that's fine, but I'm not judging that. But for a gay man or the trans or bi community or allies, we prefer vodka or gin or a craft beer. And there shouldn't be really a charge to get into the event, because if you're going to the event, you're already making a statement and supporting the whole LGBT community. And you're taking a stand for equality.
Right. You shouldn't have a cover charge for that.
You shouldn't have to pay a cover to stand for equality. That should be free.
So what are some of the events we can count on for Pride Month? What are some things that are happening that are around gay pride?
Man, well, Chicago goes all out. So, you know, of course, there's this huge blues event. It's going to be down by the lake, and it is gigantic. It is across a bunch of blocks, and there is just tons of, like, you know, the gay blues bands. Yeah, the gay blues band or blues fest. And then there's... both Cubs and White Sox are doing a ton of games during June. It's going to be incredible. I think the Cardinals are coming in for Gay Pride, so that's going to be really big, and that's going to be nice.
This just seems like that's just a regular Major League Baseball schedule. I don't know if that's...
No, this is their Pride schedule.
Oh, this
is their gay schedule. Yeah. Yeah. You know, because they're giving giveaways away at those games. And I don't think you're paying for drinks, you know, so that's pretty nice. That's pretty nice.
Is that all the events?
Well, I mean, you know, of course, the big one, which seems silly to even bring up, but, you know, it's like that Daddy's Day or Father's Day, whatever you call it. But it's all the guys, like, you know, we just gather up, and then you get, like, gifts. You get, like, a cool, like, gay tie, or you go out to breakfast, and, of course, that's open bar. And it's huge, and it's just like, you know, a lot of times we try to do everything for the whole community, but this is just the men. Like, this is just for the men. So it's awesome.
Well, it sounds like a tremendous month of events and celebrating Gay Pride here in Chicago. Our Downloads Gay Pride Month correspondent, Jim Bennett. Thanks for being here, Jim.
Oh, my God. I love it. Thanks.
That's going to do it tonight for The Download. Thanks to Jim Bennett, our Gay Pride Month correspondent, Jim Bennett. Comedian with Gayco, gay and lesbian and bi themed sketch group in Chicago. He's also a teacher at Second City. So thanks to Jim. Hope to have him back. I love the, you know, Gay Blues Fest.